Lights from Hailstorm, our brand new number one song. That's it for us this week. Now, if you missed any part of our chart, get caught up at the SideshowCountdown.com.
Thanks to Tyler Connolly from Theory of the Dead Man for hanging out with us, and Dr. Quinar for being on the show.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
And we'll see you freaks next weekend.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Tonight I have a look and try to find my face again. Buried beneath this house, my spirit screams and dies again. Outback a monster wears a cloak of Persian leather. Behind the TV screen, I'm falling to my knees. I said, you got me where you want me. Flushed by all the fallen leaves, a hand holds up the sky while shamefully I make my plea. The altar's calling, but my legs won't seem to stand. Guess I'm a coward, scared to face the man I am. I said, you got me where you want me.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
All right, thank you very much. Hey, Jolene.
Hi, Peter. Another Sunday. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to be here, too. So many things happening. And actually, starting off with some good things. We're usually just talking about all the nasty things that are happening in the world. Man, there are some bad things going on.
Yeah.
We'll get to those as well. I was downtown last night.
Yeah.
And the joint was jumping.
Yes, good.
Just jumping.
What were you doing, Peter?
I was not
you
at the...
You weren't at the rock show.
No, Kid Rock meet the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Kid Rock jams with the DSO.
I was amazed by this.
It was
a really cool concept, one that he said that they've been working on for about a year now. And he played with them, and they raised $1 million for the DSO, which is wonderful because it's an organization that has been hurting, and they were on strike for a while, and
True.
They took cuts, and they've been struggling. So kid sweeps in and saves the day.
Music director of the DSO, Detroit Symphony Orchestra, Leonard Slatkin, who was dubbed Badass Slatkin.
I love it.
By Kid Rock.
I guess it was filled with lots of curse words throughout the night.
Well, not from the DSO.
Not from the DSO. Of course from Kid Rock. And, you know, Leonard Slatkin said, because the crowd during just this, the orchestra's opening was going crazy. They were digging it. And he said, can we just take you everywhere with us?
They played Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, which is...
I know this one.
It's covered by Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Oh, right.
That's right. Beethoven's...
I know the original.
Beethoven's Fifth, though, is most famous. And then, man, that the William Tell Overture, you know, the Lone Ranger.
Hey, you know, can you imagine an alcohol-fueled rocker crowd? They were probably like, yeah, write it out, baby.
Well, it was a lot of money. Wasn't it like $100 at least?
I don't know.
But I was down there as well at another event, and you heard me live on the radio.
I did hear you live on the radio.
My applause, at least.
Yeah, you did. Well, the
Pagliacci,
Detroit Opera, yeah, Pagliacci.
Which is also hurting badly. And, of course, in the wealthiest country in the world,
aren't as alive as we
could hope
for.
Who cares about the arts?
Yeah, I mean, there's women's bodies to control. Come on, let's take it. There's wars to be fought, right?
No, don't lighten up. We never lighten up.
Well, actually, sometimes people get mad when we lighten up too much. So.
Let's wish everybody a happy Mother's Day.
Yes, absolutely.
And if you don't happen to be a mother, well, I wish you a happy Mother. Stay.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
Okay,
sure.
We'll do that. And we can add Mother's Day to all these other left-wing holidays and, well, not holidays, really, but all these writings. Remember last week I was saying...
co-opted?
Well, no. The Pledge of Allegiance was written by a socialist. This Land is Your Land was written by a communist.
Yeah.
America the Beautiful was written by a lesbian.
Right. Very diverse.
It's all very... This is probably not, but this, you know, if you're really a right winger, the idea that the inscription at the base of the Statue of Liberty was written by a Jewish poetess,
yes,
that probably would rankle some of them
question.
But also, now we can add Mother's Day to that. And frequently, on Mother's Day, I've read...
I think you've made me read it before.
Yeah, Julia Ward Howe's Mother's Day Proclamation. And she wrote the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
As well.
This was when all the Union soldiers went marching to bring to whip hand all those traitors and rebels in the South.
Nice,
Yeah.
Nice guys.
The ones that wounded my great-great-grandpappy.
That's right.
Red Bigham. He sounds like a Southerner, doesn't he?
Sounds like a racist.
Yeah, Red Bigham.
I hope he wasn't.
No, he was from Ohio.
Okay.
No, I was from I'm confused. Either he was either with the Michigan Volunteers or the Ohio Volunteers.
I don't know.
But in any event,
close enough.
Yeah. Remember, if you're flying the Confederate flag, you are flying a flag of the worst traitors to America that's ever,
It screams racism, put in quite simple
terms. Well, now too that
don't do it.
Yeah.
But I haven't had to.
Well, they don't think they care about that. But it's a flag of, it's a traitorous flag.
Absolutely.
Traitorous flag.
You know, it's amazing.
You can't be a good American and fly a Confederate flag.
You can't.
No.
And I haven't had anyone on Facebook as of late who's had one of the, I get rid of them right away. So see you later, MS.
Yeah. Well, that Battle Hymn of the Republic, it was, you know, John Brown's body, Liza Mulderman in the grave, but she changed the words, Julia Ward Howe did, and she also issued a Mother's Day proclamation that essentially was an anti-war proclamation, because she had seen the carnage of both of the American Civil War, which was of all the people that those people flying that awful flag caused. It was more than the total of all of the Americans that have died in subsequent wars.
Amazing.
And they have just, and I don't want to give a figure if I'm not sure I had this at one point, but they've raised the figure of the dead, you know. All because these people wanted to keep slavery, and that racism, unfortunately, continues to today.
Sick. And we see it just blaringly, the biggest example, with our President of the United States and the disrespect he's shown.
Yeah, you know, somehow or other, where is that? I just saw that.
Which one?
Yeah. that this Texas inmate won 41%
in West Virginia.
In West Virginia,
over
Barack Obama.
Yeah,
yeah. Although Republicans
I saw the headline and I just my head spun. What gives?
Well, this
Texas
is a state. This is a state filled with poor white people.
Yeah.
That are so blinded by their stupid racism,
right,
that they would vote for a Texas inmate who is in jail for extortion. And,
wow.
And, but this is interesting.
It's really sad.
To be eligible for the ballot, all that this, what is his name? Judd, I can't find his first name. Anyway, all he had to do was pay a $2,500 filing fee. Thank you. It's easy for you to say. And fill out a notarized certification of announcement along with meeting other residency and age requirements. This guy, but he's in jail in Texas.
We know how they move him around.
Yeah. But the point being, where did he get the $2,500?
Well, maybe he probably had a campaign of racists.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Let's
racists have money, too.
Can you see? Let me turn this. Can you see this?
Let me see that. Yes, I can see that.
This is Newsweek. It's a picture of President Obama, and it says the first gay president.
And it has like an angel
halo
rainbow.
Which is the rainbow.
You know, and I know they're getting at that he's the first president to come out and actually say that he thinks that gay marriage should be allowed.
Yeah.
And this is one of the big headlines of this past week. And it's been met with, of course, the typical, give me a good word other than idiocy of the right.
Well, why are we concentrating
hatred
on that? Yeah. I mean, these people are filled with hatred.
Yeah.
You know, here, I didn't show you this. This is a cartoon strip that appears in the New York Times every week.
You know, that's
week.
Like probably the only part of the New York Times I don't read is the cartoons.
And the cartoons, they have this very elderly man looking in the mirror and looking horrified. And he says, oh, no, I wasted my life obsessing over the lives of gay strangers. Oh, no, I wasted my life obsessing over the lives of gay strangers.
That in other says words, it all right there.
What the hell is it to you or anybody else?
It's just kind of like this John Travolta scandal that's going
on. Oh, let's not even
right
go there
now
with him.
Poor guy.
He's so gay anyway.
Is he?
I think so.
Who cares?
Who cares?
Maybe he and his wife have an arrangement.
Yeah.
People have arrangements.
None of your beeswax.
Right. Stay
right
out of
either
their or their sexual organs.
Right. Well, so President Obama has said that he personally has no problem. In fact, he said he supported the idea of same-sex marriages.
And you know how it all started, because Joe Biden made a statement, and so it made it sound like the White House was making the statement, and right?
But on you know what we haven't done? We haven't given the basics.
Phone numbers.
We want to hear what you think about President Obama's announcement that he personally supports gay marriage.
Yes.
However, don't get all worried, conservatives, because he declared his personal support for same-sex marriage, but the White House chose not to push for repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act, so there's no policy. That President Obama said this is a matter to be left to the states.
And that is the worst, because states' rights, to me, there's one word that comes out blaring, and one, but there's many, racism.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is exactly
slavery.
The right of the states to determine the laws like this that had to do with how people were treated. They said they had the right to do it. And if they wanted to discriminate in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and the rest of those places, that was okay.
Have at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it took a legal decision, the Supreme Court, and laws in the mid-60s after this enormous civil rights campaign in the 50s and the 60s where the whites launched these enormous terrorist attacks, assassinations, and all sorts of other horrible things against people that had the radical agenda of, what was it now? Oh, yeah, wanting to vote and wanting to sit on a bus where they want. So kill them, right?
All.
Blow up little kids. Shoot and torture civil rights workers.
Lynch people.
Yeah, lynch people
horrible
as well.
Yeah.
So the party platform of the Democratic Party, so don't worry. But here, let's get to this. You know, as we were saying, the conservatives have been on the wrong side of every question of social justice since the beginning of this country.
True.
And if you can name me, please call us. Do we even give that? 313-298-WRIF.
It's 313-298-9743. We have open lines. This is a phone-in talk show.
Yeah. And you can email us, though, at calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Yeah.
We have a Facebook, and we like more likes.
Come on along. All you have to do is go to facebook.com/nightcall. When you see the one that says Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan, that
yeah.
would be us.
And this is filled with photos of me and Jolene, which the only problem she thinks is wrong with those
what?
Photos is that I'm in it.
No, why do you say that? Yeah. Well, you know, ever since I took the one picture where I have to say I was having a good hair day,
yeah.
and you had your eyes closed and I didn't care, you've been a little sore at
have,
me ever since. And you said, you look at you, you don't even care.
Let's get back to the cons, the conservatives. They've been on the wrong side of everything, right? And I've ran through this litany before, but this is a little different. One of the things that happened with these conservatives, that and they wanted to conserve things as they are, they always had some arguments. The vast majority of American people, sooner or later, didn't agree with it. Like, for instance, the conservatives during the period of the American Revolution, they wanted to stay as part of Britain, a colony mm-hmm. of Britain. And they had an argument for it, which I'm not even going to go into. They, when finally the country was established and it was the vote was limited to propertied white males, they had an argument why that should remain. People like Alexander Hamilton called the people the great beast. These guys, you know, they were the planters and the rich guys and all that, and they had a good head for setting up a formal democracy, but they weren't real big on spreading it. And so mm-hmm. there was a very
Sounds
conservative
familiar.
Wing to it. There was also a very radical wing to it, you know, Jefferson and Thomas Paine and people like that. But their argument was that that unpropertied white men could not be trusted because they didn't own property or anything like that. So we got beyond, so they had an argument. Slavery had an argument to it. These people that were enslaved weren't full human beings and had only the capacity.
Yeah, they were a fraction.
Yeah, they had only. So there, it was a horrible, hideous argument that was justified by the Bible and all this other stuff. But they had an argument for it. Women were not smart enough to vote, and they were
yep.
too temperamental. This, you know,
oh, yes.
this
that,
was the
that.
Argument conservatives had against extending the vote to women.
You know, they get that time of the month, Peter.
Yeah,
so
well, that was all. That was all
part of it. Rational when that happens, right?
And segregation and forbidding people of color to vote was the same thing.
Yeah.
Is that they only had the intellect of children. They couldn't, you know, there was an hideous, stupid, racist, vile arguments that fortunately with most people are in the trash bin of history, but there was an argument there. I mean, it was bad, and they, you know, we got over it. Then the conservatives said you can't allow people to organize into unions because you know what'll happen. It'll wreck the economy. Of course, what they did was create, well, forgetting about what they did do, they were wrong, but they wanted to conserve something where working people were not able to combine to have any power, not get the minimum wage, not have
yeah.
Social
no
Security
quality of life.
Or anything like that. And then, you know, we were said, well, boy, if we withdrew from Vietnam, the commies would be in Hawaii soon enough. And the conservatives said, we got to keep fighting this war with all these working class guys. You know, most of these guys, you know, Rush Limbaugh and they're what's called chicken hawks.
Yeah, they didn't go, but they are all pro-war.
Or George Bush, who was able to have his rich daddy get him into the National Guard, and he was AWOL.
And AWOL. God, I'm so tired of talking about him, aren't we?
So, but there was an argument there. So the conservatives who wanted to conserve everything exactly as it was, I mean, which would have been, you know, if they would have had their way, we'd be a colony of Britain with slaves. Actually, it's a little complicated, but I don't even want to get into it. I mean, one of the reasons that the South went along, the slave states went along with, or the slave colonies went along with the Constitution, they were afraid that Britain was going to abolish slavery.
Right.
But in any event, if the conservatives would have had their way, let's say that the only people that would have voted in, well, no, we wouldn't even have voted. We would have been colonies of Britain.
Yeah.
Or if you would at least got to the Revolutionary War, it would have been a country run by the 1%. Oh, hey, it still is, isn't it?
Yes,
oh,
right, it is.
Oh, well,
that's what those signs in our yards are about, Peter.
There goes my argument.
99%.
There goes my argument.
Out the window.
All right, so gay marriage. Here is the conservative argument against gay marriage.
What is it? Oh, they don't have one?
They don't have one.
They just don't want it to exist.
Yeah, they don't.
That's their argument.
In this lawsuit against this Proposition 8 in California, which forbid gay marriage, when the defendants, I can't remember what side they were on, they could not enunciate a single argument what was going to happen, how the social body, how individuals, how groups, how institutions, how anybody was going to suffer.
Right.
They couldn't come up with a single thing, you know?
And yet it still passed.
Yeah. So this is completely based in religion.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. All right.
And tradition. Traditionally, they're right. Traditional marriage has been,
men and women.
Men and women. So, you know, who's stopping anybody?
And it's going so well for so many people.
Well, that's the thing. You know, they have this Defense of Marriage Act, right? And who's like really going for it? Rush Limbaugh. Yeah. He's only been married 4 times. And, I guess my friends who have the record are only 3. But
I don't have the record.
What are you, 2?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't care if people have been married 10 times.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I would feel badly because usually these marriages wind up in unhappy situations.
Pretty bad track record.
But the defense of marriage doesn't. The assailant is not gay people or gay marriage. It's these heterosexuals that can't maintain their marriages.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not disparaging people who get divorces or it's just a sad state of affairs.
It happens.
Think about this. The Defense of Marriage Act was signed in 1996, and it was driven by none other than Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, who is on number three.
Yeah.
Which we're not saying about the number, but then he...
He was boinking his...
horrible things.
Yeah, yeah. He was boinking number three.
Was he the one with the cancer?
With wife that he said, yeah, I got to tell you this. We're ending this.
She's dying of cancer.
Yeah, and then his third wife, what's her name?
Calista.
He told the one before that he wanted to have an open marriage.
Yeah, after he'd been involved with Calista for 2 years.
Yeah.
It's like the whole open marriage thing, you need to set those things up from the start. You know, you need to lay those grounds. So because then it's like, I've been cheating, now I want to be able to cheat kind of legally.
Let's put this out here as well as we always do. If there is somebody that can tell us, you know, we argue with people pretty badly, but, you know, sometimes you don't want to call up and get that in your face. If someone can call up with a good reason why everybody shouldn't be allowed to marry, I'd like to know that. You know, I'd like to know who.
Yeah.
I
mean, just please.
Yeah.
Give me one thing. It's unnatural.
So what?
Love is natural.
Yeah,
I don't care who
it is. Even if you could make an argument, it's unnatural. So what? You know,
what's it to you?
What's it to you? Yeah.
Boink your own wife or
and
whatever.
And you know what? You know why it's natural? Because people do it.
Yeah, people do it.
It's got to be natural.
They do it a lot.
You know how long they've been doing it?
I mean, since the beginning of time.
Yeah, yeah. Like that. And I don't know why. All these organized religions have always had prohibitions against it and very harsh denunciations, right?
Yeah.
And, Jesus was...
I mean, they're still doing that.
Wait a minute.
You know? Wait. No, what?
No, Jesus didn't say anything about this. That's right. So now comes this hideous character. I mean, I didn't think he could arise to the level of such despicable opportunism and vile statements. You know, I'm talking about Mitt Romney. Willard Romney.
Like, which one? Yeah, I mean, Willard Romney had a really bad week.
Yeah, he did. He was a gay bashing bully, but also, in some ways, this is the worst. He showed up in Lynchburg, Virginia yesterday. Yeah, yesterday. And, which is called the spiritual heart of the conservative movement.
And they should change the name of that damn town, too.
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Yeah, terrible.
Lynchburg.
That's terrible.
Oh, my God. Hey, you got comments on what we're saying.
If I lived there, I'd start a protest immediately.
Give us a call. Same week that President Obama galvanized his base by endorsing same-sex marriage, Mr. Romney's view was that evangelicals could count on him to operate as a president under a common worldview, including his position that marriage should be between only a man and a woman. Marriage is a relationship between one man and one woman, he said. Well, his granddaddy didn't believe that. Yeah, that's why, as a Mormon,
his grandfather truly was polygamous and moved the family to Mexico so they could live in polygamous freedom.
Now, here's what he said. He repeatedly invoked God and cited an array of Christian leaders and thinkers, And he talked about tradition from America's beginnings of trusting in God, not man. This is just total crap.
Where is he coming
from? No, he's making this up.
He's making everything up.
Religious liberty is the first freedom in our Constitution. Well, you know what? He's wrong. Because it's the first freedom, but the first, let me get it here.
Get that Constitution out
that I carry with me at all times.
Gets me all excited 14th. When you get that Constitution out.
That's how I used to do when I used to go out on dates.
Yeah, it's like, hey, let me show you something, honey.
Hey, baby, let me show you
my Constitution.
You know what I got in my pocket.
Is that a Constitution in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me? Sorry. I'm done.
Congress shall make, this is Amendment 1, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. So then it says, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So in a sense, he's right that although it's not, it's the second phrase, the first thing that Congress, the framers did of the Constitution was they wanted to make sure there was no establishment of religion. So fearful were they of the commingling of the political state and
the
religion.
Church.
Yeah.
Which is why that separation of church and state still exists to this day, but it really kind of
being afraid. Yeah. And they didn't want free exercise thereof because a lot of the colonies would say you can only practice this brand. So off Romney goes to this Liberty College.
Oh, this is so gross. Can I say one more thing that he said in this last article from the Times that we're looking at? He said, and whether the cause is justice for the persecuted, compassion for the needy and the sick. I mean, he's just blowing it out his ass at this point. And he said, or mercy for the child waiting to be born. There is no greater force for good in the nation than Christian conscience in action. Could I vomit now?
Well, and the reason that Jillian is saying that is because it completely contravenes the sentiment of the first sentence of the First Amendment to the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. He goes to a Christian university that says the mission of Liberty University has been to develop Christ-centered men and women with the values, knowledge, and skills essential to impact tomorrow's world. More than 40 years of educating young champions to impact the world for Christ. I'm not even quite sure what that means.
Yeah, because the world isn't all for Christ.
Yeah.
It's a lot of religions.
Liberty University was established in 1971 by the Reverend Jerry Falwell. The Reverend Jerry Falwell was called by Senator John McCain. You may remember him from a long time ago, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
He called Falwell, quote, an agent of intolerance. And I just happened to pick up, do I have it here? I do indeed. Here's some of the statements. And this is the man that founded the university where George Romney is speaking. He says...
George Romney, he said.
I said George Romney?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, his kid.
Yeah.
George Romney was the governor of Michigan and was a fairly good guy, the last of the liberal Republicans. Anyway, this is from something called the 10 Craziest Things Reverend Jerry Falwell Ever Said. It's from About.com. I'm not going to mention them all. He says, the idea that religion and politics don't mix was invented by the devil to keep Christians from running their own country.
Wow.
And I'm sure, by the way, he doesn't mean Catholics or Mormons, certainly not Jews or Muslims.
He's kind of Christian.
Or atheists, yeah. He says, and this is Reverend Jerry Falwell, who founded the school where Romney spoke yesterday, I hope to live to see the day when we won't have any public schools. The churches will have taken them over again and Christians will be running them. What a happy day that will be.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
This is like an Ayatollah speaking.
Yeah, it really is.
Here's another thing that Jerry Falwell said. AIDS is the wrath of a just God against homosexuals. To oppose AIDS would be like an Israelite jumping into the Red Sea to save one of Pharaoh's charioteers. AIDS is not just God's punishment for homosexuals. It is God's punishment for the society that tolerates homosexuals. What an evil. I want to use the F word so badly.
I know. We're not
I want to use
satellite.
It so badly. This effing
just
son of a
it.
Bitch.
Just think it.
This horrible man talking about Christian values. And the Christians I know, that these kind-hearted, tolerant, loving
my
people.
My whole family,
yeah.
Except for me, obviously.
Here's one crazy thing that Jerry Falwell said. Grown men should not be having sex with prostitutes unless they are married to them.
What?
So you're their pimp and you're married to him kind of thing. And then you get the freebies.
Yeah. Jerry Falwell, who founded the Liberty University, where Romney spoke yesterday, said Billy Graham is the chief servant of Satan in America.
Wow.
He also said, remember he warned that Tinky Winky, a character on the Teletubbies, may be gay because he's wearing...
Teletubbies, yeah.
What did I say?
Yeah, Teletubbies. It's okay. That's here for you.
Yeah, yeah. Teletubbies. That's what? Jewish grandmothers on television, I guess. Yeah. He said that Tinky Winky may be gay because he's in purple, the gay pride color, and his antenna is shaped like a triangle, the gay pride symbol.
This is how stupid he is. He doesn't realize the gay pride color is actually a rainbow of colors.
Yeah. Now, one wonders how this man could continue to exist. I didn't even know he died in 2007.
Yeah.
Did you? No one told me.
I did know.
Did you tell me? No one told me.
Well, Peter, you know.
So he founded this university.
I didn't want to break your heart.
And how could anybody of conscience appear at a university where the man that founded it said the abortionists have got to bear some burden for 9/11 because God will not be mocked. I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU and this group called People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped 9/11 happen.
Jeez. So I, as a feminist, and whatever else I am.
And me as a Teletubby.
And you as a Teletubby. I mean, we should be ashamed. That guy was truly insane. And really, for Mitt Romney, like you said, to speak there, I can't even, he's running for the president of the United States, not for president of like the religious council or something, you know?
Exactly. Rand Paul, who's dumber than his father, says he didn't think Obama's views could get any gayer.
I know. He really, I thought this was a joke. I thought it was The Onion.
Well, we've got to be sure. He said the biblical, this is Rand Paul, said the biblical golden rule caused him to be for gay marriage. I'm like, what version of the Bible is he reading? Well, there's a lot of Christians that, you know, that support gay marriage, and there's gay churches around, and
Universalist, yeah. Unitarian.
Well, we forgot to say when we're talking about heterosexual hypocrisy in terms of talking about marriage needs defending and all that, that it was, you know, Rush Limbaugh's like all against gay marriage, and he's the one then, you know, his manner of not adhering to marriages, you could argue, are the what's really threatening heterosexual marriage. And Newt Gingrich, this serial philanderer, was pushing it. But then it was signed by, in 1996, Bill Clinton.
That is fair share fun.
So one of the things we've been asking is can there anyone come up with the slightest possible, and we'll take the slightest possible because remember, there are arguments against the American Revolution, against men without property voting, against women voting, arguments for segregation, for the Vietnam and Afghan and Iraq wars. So, I mean, there's arguments there. But when it comes to arguments for gay marriage,
Crickets.
Yeah. You got one? I'd like to hear it. And it can't be. Well, yeah, you can
it
say.
It can be whatever you want.
It can be whatever you want.
Did you say we were going to be nice?
No, we will be beyond nice. We won't even argue. We'll say, okay.
We'll say, okay.
Thank you.
We can't even say, okay, that's your argument.
Yeah. So let's keep bashing.
Crazy people.
Yeah, Mitt Romney. Who is a gay bashing bully, as it turns out. But
A lot of people may not know that, Peter, but maybe we should wait till after the break to
tell
that part.
We should. But one of the things is people have argued, hey, look, that was in 1965. And whatever he may have done as, what do they call it, a prank or a hijink?
Hijinks.
What is a hijink?
Hijinks.
I know. Well, that's a singular.
Oh, okay. I've never heard it called hijinks.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It was hijinks. You're right. It's an X at the end. It's hijinks. That was just hijinks. Maybe you're right. Yeah. But so they say, well, you know, he's a kid. You know, actually, he was a rich.
He was just a boy.
He was just a rich snot.
Yeah. Rich little brat.
Yeah.
A mean little rich kid.
Yeah. And but what if he's lying? All right. We'll talk about that when we come back. Okay. Your calls. Hey.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls.
calls right after this.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. We're talking about George. I keep calling him George by his dad's name. Mitt Romney's. Yeah. Appearance at Liberty University. Darina wrote it in on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/nightcall, that Liberty University is neither. Actually, they've turned out about, 100,000, oh yeah, 100,000 students, for Christ for America, forgetting about the fact that the Constitution says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What in the hell was a candidate for president doing there?
Yeah. And
a lot
trying
of them
to get
gone
the religious vote, period.
Yeah, yeah. And he says, though, that he will enact those values. So he's going to turn this from a secular nation into a religious nation. He also has been accused of gay bashing, being a gay bashing bully outside
at Cranbrook.
Cranbrook.
I guess I didn't realize he went to Cranbrook.
Oh, yeah.
But that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, that's where just all rich kids.
Right.
Now it's somewhat more diverse, although
good.
Still it's an elite school. I've got at least three good friends
who teach there. I was just out there yesterday.
Beautiful
as a matter
place.
Of fact, yeah, my 15-year-old next-door neighbor has a girlfriend who goes to school there. So
to Kingswood.
I dropped her off. She had 8 o'clock curfew.
So the question that everybody's been posing is, hey, this happened in 1965. Well, you got to remember in this interview on where else, Fox Radio, Romney laughed as he said he didn't remember the incident, although he acknowledged that, quote, back in high school, I did some dumb things. And if anybody was hurt by that or offended, obviously I apologize. And he said, I participated in a lot of hijinks and pranks during high school, and some might have gone too far. And for that, I apologize. Well, you would think, well, okay, he's apologizing.
Yeah, well, yeah. But then when you find out what he did.
Yeah. So what he did was there was also that every time this guy spoke in class, they'd shout out at a girl because he had dyed his hair blonde. And then he walked a blind teacher into a closed door and then giggled hysterically.
Ugh.
And he's that here. Let me see.
Okay, so this John Lauber.
Lauber, a soft-spoken new student, 1 year behind Romney, who quote was perpetually teased for his nonconformity and presumed homosexuality. Lauber bleached his hair, which apparently quote incensed Romney. So one day, Romney reportedly led a posse of other boys shouting about their plan to cut Lauber's hair. According to the article, the boys came upon Lauber, tackled him, pinned him to the ground. As Lauber's eyes filled with tears, screamed for help, Romney reportedly clipped his hair.
Repeatedly.
Clipped his hair with a pair of scissors.
He did it.
One of the boys involved described Lauber as terrified. Another schoolmate said that Lauber was just easy pickings.
Another called the incident vicious. It was vicious, just as vicious. And this is a human being. It's what he did to his dog by, strapping it on top of the car and going for a 10-hour car ride.
So I've known kids like this. These rich snots with, when we were lucky to have an old beat-up Ford, of course.
I was one of those little rich kids, admittedly.
I sure
but I never acted that way. I wasn't raised to be a total ass like this.
But one people said, look, this was a long time ago. It was... almost 50 years ago, he's changed a lot. Here's a couple of things that occur to me. One, it's an absolute lie that he didn't remember. Everyone else involved remembered.
Yes.
Yeah. The person that was the victim of Mitt Romney died a few years
ago. It's a political disease.
Yeah.
Not remember.
Everyone else remembered, so he's lying. The other thing is that he said, back then people didn't know about gays, weren't concerned about gays. That's total BS. I mean, it's total BS. I mean, we're starting to, get into an era where people's overt or covert sexuality was, becoming more and more of a social issue.
Sure.
So he knew about this. But, Romney, he probably, he was like back in the 50s, and he still is.
Yeah, he really is.
Yeah.
You look at him, he looks like he's right out of one of those. Is it Mad Men that's in the 50s?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. So your opinion about Romney speaking at Liberty University, where the man that founded it said that the ACLU and abortionists were responsible for 9/11 because God took his wrath out upon us.
That, I mean, that's not crazy at all.
No. Right. And what do you think about President Obama's saying that he supports gay marriage? And what about the fact that he said, I want to leave it up to the states? I think that's pretty bad.
I think it's bad, too. And also, what about Mitt Romney and this bullying thing? Because bullying is so prevalent in our society these days. I just had a friend's child, you know, hung himself. Or he blew his head off about a month ago because he was being bullied in my hometown of Des Moines, Iowa. Did it with his dad's gun. Sure. So there's the gun thing, too, right?
Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, this is Night Call, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Justin in Port Huron. Justin, welcome. Thanks for being our first caller. What's up?
Not too much. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good. Hi, Justin.
Good. How's it going? I just wanted to talk about the gay marriage thing. You know, I don't something agree or disagree with it.
Okay.
I feel like it's not my business or anybody else's business who gets married. I mean, if you love each other.
Yeah.
Right.
I said our government's going to crap. I mean, it shouldn't be anybody's say. I mean, it's supposed to be a free country. I mean, it's like me, someone telling me I can't marry my wife.
Well, it is.
Right. Imagine how that feels.
I mean, they've had rules like that or laws like that in the United States. It used to be that, African Americans and European Americans, so white and black, couldn't get married. You know that there was.
It wasn't even that long ago.
I bet it does. It sounds like a long time ago to Justin. Until 1967, there were laws in Virginia that said that blacks and whites couldn't marry. In Nazi Germany, Jews couldn't legally get married after a while. So, yeah, it has a bad precedent. And I think what we need, Justin, if there's somebody that's going to tell us the argument for banning gay marriage, and we haven't heard anything yet, but I appreciate your sentiments. Exactly. It ain't nobody's business but the people involved.
Absolutely. Good attitude.
All right. Thank
you
very much. Appreciate that. Let's see. Here is Daryl. Daryl's in Romulus. Hey, Daryl. Hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I got about three things I want to say. One, I cannot stand Romulus at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second thing is people should leave the Mormon religion alone because that's what my religion is.
Mormon?
Okay,
you're talking just a little fast. Okay, so you said leave the Mormon. Okay, yeah.
Okay, here's the thing. I was born and raised in the church ever since I was a kid.
Okay.
I was baptized into the church, okay?
Yeah.
Here's the thing. We only believe in having one wife and one husband. We don't believe in having a harem. If one of us got caught doing polygamy, we would be kicked out. That's what the FDS is all about out in Utah. They have nothing to do with our religion. They are ex-members of the church.
Well, you know, in fairness, Daryl, that's like there's the Catholic Church, and then the Protestants didn't like the way the main church was functioning, so they broke off a long time ago. So now there's tons of Protestant religions. But these folks that still have polygamous arrangements, they still consider themselves Mormons. I mean, a lot of really strict Catholics do not consider any Protestants to be proper Christians. You know what? I'll tell you, though. I don't care. You know, that's just those folks and their religion and whatever.
I don't either.
Yeah, you know, go for it. Who is the real Christian? Who is the real Mormon? Who's the real Catholic?
Who's the real atheist?
Ain't any business of mine. But thank you, Daryl. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Never mind. And you think about all that. Every religion has these, you know, different little sects in it, and they are the only true ones, you know. So, I mean, it's all kind of scary to me because usually these religions wind up killing people that don't agree with them.
Yeah, war, things like that.
Yeah, against each other.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, think
right.
about, you know. Like,
big things like that.
Yeah, big things like that. Here's Richard in Royal Oak. Let's talk about gay marriage. Richard, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Welcome.
How you guys doing tonight?
We're good. What's up?
When it comes to gay marriage, there's nothing anybody can really say about it other than it's, like Justin said, it's their lives and it's what they want to do.
Yeah.
The big thing to me is there's no interruption to social society. There's no interruption to the economy. They're just a part of everybody's life, and they're there. You know, they're not going anywhere. And I say they are because it's men and women. And you can't segregate them. They're a part of our lives. And these, a lot of these people do good in the world for everybody, and a lot of people just dismiss them because they are gay. And that's wrong.
Well, they undoubtedly probably have a spread of, you know, good and bad, you know, just like the regular population. Although I gotta say,
right,
from the, you know, Jillian and I live in an area that has
separately.
Probably separately, yeah, that has probably a larger percentage of gay people than,
yes,
than a lot of other areas, you know, around Ferndale, Royal Oak, you know, Pleasant Ridge. They seem to be pretty good citizens, right?
Well, they cleaned up Ferndale single-handedly 18 or so years ago.
Ferndale's kind of getting depopulated that way, but at the same time, it's, you know, you never know
what
it is unless they come out.
What's depopulated mean?
It's Ferndale is still kind of referred to as the gay community because there were so many gay people living there.
Right.
But it's actually, you know, it's moving away from that. You know, regular families are moving in.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's always been regular families.
I think more regular families are moving in. You know, it's not a gay central city.
I know he doesn't mean it in a bad way.
Yeah. You know, when I interviewed Craig Covey, who was elected as an openly gay mayor of Ferndale,
uh-huh,
I said, welcome, Mr. Mayor. I want to congratulate you on being the first gay mayor of a Michigan city. He said, let me correct you, the first openly gay. So that's true.
I still
fabulous Ferndale, yeah. You know, by the way, oh, yeah, speaking about the Constitution and some open lines now, is there anybody going to say what's wrong with gay marriage?
I mean, come on. We do this from time to time.
And no one ever comes up because there isn't anything. You got to, I mean, you know, you can't
what
say.
There's a biblical reason that they try to give, but there's really nothing hardcore in the Bible.
Yeah, but we live in a secular society. It's governed by a secular document. It was founded by men who weren't real strong into the church or anything like that. But here is what I think is going to be decided. I mean, because the conservatives and the racists that predominated in the era of segregation were Democrats, there is no way in the world that segregation was going to be voted out at the time, although eventually, you know, it was. It really took the Supreme Court to intervene in 1954 when, you know, they said schools couldn't be legally segregated. And previously in, oh, I'm forgetting my history, 1896, mm-hmm, I think it was, there was a lawsuit brought to the Supreme Court, and they said that segregation actually was okay.
Yeah.
As long as it was equal. But, of course, they brought all this evidence to show that it was terribly unequal. Yeah.
You know, and that's the thing. How many years do you think it will be until people look back and say, oh, this was truly shameful?
Yeah. I mean, because when I said to Justin, and I didn't let him give a response, that was my fault, that I said that up until 1967, that marriage in this country was still prohibited in the state of Virginia between blacks and whites, you go, whoa, I can't even believe that.
I know.
You know, if you're 18, that might as well be 1867.
I know, but really in the scheme of things,
yeah,
someday you'll realize that's not that large of a...
Now, here is, in fact, here is an article in I think today's New York Times, when President Obama's support for same-sex marriage, want me to start again?
Come on,
I will.
Now, you can do it.
I can do it. While President Obama's support for same-sex marriage is symbolic, his words have little power to erase the long list of extra costs and legal hurdles that same-sex couples face. For a more realistic chance at change, gay couples are probably better off looking to the courts. God, I think I got enough pollen in my throat.
Yeah, it's all right.
Several cases are winding their way through the judicial system, most of which challenge the Defense of Marriage Act, called DOMO, signed into law by Bill Clinton in 1996. The indignities that gay couples and their families regularly encounter are one reason many of them say they are fighting to dismantle the law, but the financial burden they also bear can be measured, and some of the court cases have brought this into focus. The New York Times quantified those costs a few years ago by tracking a fictitious gay couple over the course of their lifetime. The report found that in a worst case, a family of four would need to spend nearly $470,000 more than a heterosexual couple married in an identical situation.
With insurance? And...
Yeah. The simplest step would be to dismantle the Defense of Marriage Act, known as DOMA, But there's nothing going on for that. My throat right there. And for the first time, read that from there. Will you think? I'm going to cough off.
Okay, here we go. It goes on to say, and for the first time, there is a potentially powerful case that could make a difference because it is the first challenge to the anti-marriage law to reach a federal appeals court, a step away from the Supreme Court. The plaintiffs in two separate cases, which include seven couples and three individuals who have been denied federal benefits like Social Security payments, the right to file taxes jointly, prevailed in a lower court in Boston in 2010. Last month, a three-judge panel of the appeals court heard arguments on whether to uphold the original decision, which found the ban on federal recognition of same-sex marriage unconstitutional. And it goes on right here to say... and this is a quote from Vicki Henry, a senior staff attorney at Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders. These people have all worked decades and paid into the system, or their spouse has, and they are just shocked that they cannot get the same benefits that married people can get. They have to plan for the worst case scenario.
And no matter what you think about gays, gay marriage, or anything like that, we are governed by something called the Constitution of the United States of America. And in Amendment 14, which has to do with civil rights, it says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And here's the important clause. Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
Right.
And gay people in this country are not receiving equal protection under the law.
No.
If they got to go through all these hoops, don't get the benefits that they've paid into, can't marry, can't do everything that anyone else can. Because ultimately, you know, how do you even know someone's gay? Well, you know, a couple guys living together, you might think so, but I've lived with guys.
Might just be your roommate.
Might be.
Might
never
be.
Can tell. But you don't.
And,
but that's it. You don't know, and it ain't none of your beeswax.
Yeah, it's none of your damn business what people do in the bedroom, on the kitchen table. I don't care where they do it.
So why in the hell would anybody care other than when someone is a good citizen, is a friendly neighbor, brings cookies to so-and-so.
Or just lives their life.
And I'm talking about, you know, straight or gay. I mean, that's not important. So you go... What do they do in the bedroom? Why the hell do you want to know?
Obsessed, you sicko.
Well, yeah. Where's my comic?
And you know, also.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh. Well, let me read that again.
Sure, please.
This
do.
Comic in the New York Times. I read it early. The final panel of it. It's called Marriage Equality Horror Stories. Kind of, you know, tongue in cheek. And there's a very, very elderly man looking at himself in the mirror and saying, "Oh no. I wasted my life obsessing over the lives of gay strangers."
That's beautiful.
Yeah, so give it up. But anyway, I still would entertain a reason. You know, conservatives had real terrible reasons for everything. You know, opposing the American Revolution, slavery, women's votes, segregation, everything under the sun. But I never hear an argument why gays or gay rights or gay marriage is how that's going to hurt anybody. What's the argument for? I mean, you can say, well, God says it's bad. Okay, then you don't do it. You be a good Christian or Hindu or Jew or Muslim
you don't be
or whatever.
The big sinner.
Because all the religions condemn it. What reason number 147? I'm not religious.
Me too.
And although there's gay churches, to be sure.
There's also churches and organizations that try to teach people how not to be gay. Isn't that brilliant?
All right, let's go on with our calls. Your opinions. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mike in Fenton. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're good.
Yeah, that Willard Romney, I just can't vote for a president that has a hatred like he does. He, you know, with the gay thing. And it's not just the gay thing. It's, you know,
it's everything.
wait. Yeah. You know what I like? Mike, let me just interrupt you 1 second. I don't think he hates anybody. I think that he is such a plastic man that he will, you know.
Opportunist,
that he has no genuine, you know. Anyway, but go ahead. I know what you're saying.
No genuine thought process or thoughts whatsoever.
It's larger than that, though. It's not just Willard. It's that whole party. It's even, you know, even you guys, you stick up for the gays against the people that don't want people to be gay, so you're actually doing the same thing that they're doing.
Wait, we're celebrating love and acceptance?
I'm not saying that there's something wrong with what you're doing, but we all you know, have a lot to learn, and it's hatred for something that we don't believe, and that we want to stick our nose in somebody else's business when we should be caring more about the person or the people or the situation in that constitution. We don't live under no constitution, because if we did, they wouldn't be having a problem with the gay marriage. You know, it's really none of my business.
Well, I think, actually, we all agree on that, and that's a good thing. All right, I got to take a quick break. Thank you for your opinion. Join us. Some open lines. We'll be right back. And we'll continue talking about this, and, you know, there's some other aspect. Well, there was something that I student debt. And also, where's our money going? There's such a, you know, shortfall.
Our tax dollars?
Yeah. How about we're building, spending $500 million to build up first responders in Iraq?
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Do you like what you see when you look in the mirror? If not, maybe it's time to make some changes. Here's Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa.
Enhancing the natural beauty of your appearance brings with it tremendous boosts in self-confidence. You don't have to get undressed in the dark. I can provide you the body that you've always dreamed of. Let your mirror reveal your true inner self.
That's what we'd all like. But Dr. Gray, how does a person know where to start?
Well, first we have to figure out what it is that bothers you that's making you feel not confident about yourself. Once we can figure that out, I'll give you options. We'll sit down and review what your choices are so we can create a new you together.
So, ladies, if you're ready to get the look you've always wanted and boost your self-confidence, call Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa for a complimentary consultation at 248-538-3333 or visit anewyou.com.
Don't settle for less than you deserve. Take the first step toward living the life you've always imagined and look as good as you feel. I'm Dr. Michael Gray. Call me today, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Ever notice how people almost always have some good news and some bad news, but never good news and good news? Can people only handle so much good news? Let's see with car insurance. Good news. Esurance is now backed by the stability of Allstate, a company with over 80 years experience. More good news. Esurance still offers the same great rates. So, everyone's still breathing? Visit esurance.com or call 1-800-ESURANCE for a quote.
Not available in all states.
For over 150 years, Tag Heuer Swiss luxury watchmaker has brilliantly fused technology with design. And Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, has an incredible selection to choose from.
That's Jared!
Time and again, Tag Heuer has revolutionized watchmaking with luxury timepieces, including the sleek avant-garde Link collection and the vintage appeal of the Carrera heritage. Now at Jared.
It can only be Jared.
Find a Jared store or shop anytime at Jared.com.
Mike Rowe here at a Ford dealer with a little Q&A for Fiona. According to the signs, Ford is having some sort of a big tire event. How would you describe the event?
It's big.
The savings one might enjoy at the event.
They're big.
What about the selection?
Big.
Click the banner ad for a $100 rebate offer on four select name brand tires.
So I think we can agree then that Ford's tire event is good sized.
No, Michael. It's big.
Fiona, I'm going to take your word for it.
Offer cannot be combined. Stop by any participating Ford dealer or visit FordOwner.com for rebate details through 531-12.
Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com.
Love it.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour at 1 a.m. I'm going to have a couple of recorded interviews playing. One is, I could imagine, Jalene, how this sounds kind of boring. One on the...
You always say that, Peter.
I know, because...
You set it up to be not sexy.
I know. Well, this isn't... It's about the economy. Well, we all got to know about
well,
this.
It's kind of important, our pocketbook.
Yeah, you know. Economist Richard Wolff is going to talk about occupying the economy, challenging capitalism. In other words, these piecemeal reforms that are being suggested just aren't enough. We got to have a new view of how we run our economic life. And one of the things I say to him, I said, look, the historic alternative, like of communism, turned into be just this economy run by the police, so nobody wants that. And he answers that.
Okay.
And then Eric Larson, who wrote The People's Pension, which is Social Security, and the struggle to defend Social Security since Reagan. And he said, well, man, I'm only 19. I don't care about that.
Who's Reagan?
Reagan. Who's Reagan? It's like, wasn't he about the same time as Lincoln? Something like that. I see on our Facebook page that people are beginning to comment on the show there. Because I know,
Well, that's the way of the world. And that's the way, more and more, it's the way it's going to be.
Like my website? It's just 20th century?
No. Your website is like an encyclopedia. They can go there. It's a one-stop shopping kind of thing. I won't take totally away from your website.
Peter Werby, WERBE.com. PeterWerby.com.
Yeah. Yes, it's a great, it's a wonderful website.
Yeah.
And you can find more pictures of us on there. Anyway.
Not of us. You gotta go to the Facebook page.
Yeah. You don't have me up there anymore?
You're there. For another very nice photo.
Okay. Yeah. Was it that really old one?
Yeah, really old. It was about last year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Anyhow, we got an email about religion. We've been talking about religion. The reason the teabaggers are having such a hard time trying to break down the wall between church and state is because religion and politics are two totally different things, and they want our newspeak to consider the two as synonymous.
Ooh. Well, by the way, I was thinking, I told you that one religious friend of mine, I said, I almost feel badly, that when I just denounce religion so much.
So harshly.
And she said, I know you're not talking about us.
Right.
And
exactly.
It was really true. What has happened? Because, I don't exactly agree with that writer, because we've seen throughout history, with the beginning of these city states that emerged out of the primitive tribes like 4,000 years ago and formed the first authoritarian, hierarchical, patriarchal states. Mm-hmm. How in the world were they going to justify the fact that they were the ruler? Well, guess what? They were given that power by God or the gods or whatever.
Right.
And, that had happened into the 18th century. King Louis. Louis? Louis? What was his name? Louis.
King Louis. Louis.
Yeah, of France, right. They were all... And that's what changed with the American Revolution, that people were no longer subjects, that they were citizens. But religion and politics have always been conjoined, and always to the detriment of the people, because the rulers, the elite, always use religion to beat people down and to rule over people and be one of their instruments of oppression.
Absolutely.
And whenever you have one nation under God, the best current example is probably Iran. You have a miserable state of affairs. And that's exactly what these right-wing Christians want. And if they don't want to be disparaged, if they don't want to be mocked, if they don't want to be ridiculed by people like me and others, and I don't think in much of their belief, but I don't say that to my friends who don't bring it up to me. And the fact that these people are trying to shove it down our throat. Should I give that one analogy again? You like
which
that
one?
About how religion is like a penis? That's always worth telling.
Bring it.
Yeah. Religion is like a penis. It's okay to have one. It's even okay to be proud of it.
Yeah.
But don't try to shove it down people's throats.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the people that I am criticizing aren't religionist, in and of themselves.
Right.
It's that they are religious politicians.
Yeah, the ones that are using it just to get votes, which is so...
Or the ones that sincerely, deeply believe it. I'm not.
But it's so unauthentic. What Mitt Romney is doing, and, he's first of all, he's a Mormon, which, we've already established that we don't give a hoot, right, yeah. Peter? But then he's going to this Liberty University that was started by
Jerry Falwell,
that crazy late Jerry Falwell, and he's going there trying to get the Christian vote. It's just so repulsive.
Well, listen, all right, whoa, we got somebody has opposition to gay marriage. Dennis from Farmington, stay on. I've been holding off Steve from Rochester for so long. Let's Steve, you're on the air. Welcome. I'm sorry you had to wait so long. Go ahead, you're on the air.
No worries, Peter. I love the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Mitt Romney bullying thing real quick.
Where he cut the hair of this young gay student when he was a high school student back at Cranbrook in 1965. Yeah, and lied.
Yeah, cut his hair against his will.
Yeah,
and
lied. Yeah, it was terrible.
And lied and lies about it now. Said he doesn't remember and that gays weren't an issue then, which is nuts.
And he ran a blind teacher into a closed door and giggled hysterically about
it. Okay, but go ahead, Steve.
Well, yeah, I was wondering if you guys had read the Brian Dickerson article in the Detroit Free Press today.
No, didn't see it. I should have.
Oh, it was great. What he was talking about was that, yeah, what Mitt Romney did as a child, as a teenager, yeah, that was terrible. It was stupid. But we all did terrible things as children and as teenagers. But
I didn't.
Well, okay. But
the worst thing I did was drugs, man.
Okay, go ahead.
But what's more telling is his response, because it could have been a beautiful moment. It could have been him talking about how, yeah, it was bad and we need to do something about how kids are terrible.
It could have been a teaching moment about bullying. Instead, all he did was try to cover his ass.
Yeah, exactly.
He said he didn't remember it. Everybody else involved remembered it.
He's so full of.
Oh, he remembered it. Everybody
of course.
Knows he remembered it.
Yeah.
I just thought that was an interesting article, and I thought that you might enjoy it.
I'll check it out, Steve. I mean, I think the what's instructive here, partly that kids that are rich snots like Romney, who right. Hit a home run and were born on third base and thinks they hit a home run, right?
That's good.
And he's lying about not remembering it, obviously, and he's lying about the fact that nobody had any concerns about gays. I mean, gays have been ridiculed and attacked and what have forever. Yeah. All right, Steve, thank you very much.
And he was
appreciate your call.
Just another part of the issue, right? The problem.
Yeah. Here's Dennis from Farmington. Dennis, welcome to the broadcast. Hi. You have it, man. Go ahead.
How's it going? Are you guys surprised that nobody's calling in to oppose this? I mean, I don't really think that those people are your demographic on the show, you know what I mean?
What, the haters?
No. One of the things I said, Dennis, and I'm going to let you give your reasons, but one of the things I said is that conservatives have opposed every forward extension of democracy in this country has ever experienced, but the conservatives always had arguments against, civil rights, against
rights for workers,
women, all that. But I never hear any arguments against gay marriage. What do you got for us?
Well, I'm from Detroit originally, and I ended up moving to a town called Carthage, Illinois.
Okay.
And Carthage, Illinois, it's kind of interesting. They got a big history, against the Mormons. When I first moved there, I saw a bunch of Utah plates, and I'm like, what is all this, you know? And what I found was that back years ago, Joseph Smith used to be the leader of the Mormon church.
Right.
And what happened was they threw him in jail, and a mob of Carthage folks came and basically dragged him and his brother out of the jail, and they lynched these guys, right? And then what happened that winter, the Mississippi froze over, so Brigham Young took the Mormon clan, and they headed out to Salt Lake City, and that's kind of where they ended up. But as a result, I guess every Mormon's got to make a trek back to Carthage.
Well, that's incredible. Let me just insert one other thing. There was another faction of Mormons that wound up on Beaver Island, which is off of Charlevoix, which I've sailed to from there. In fact, let me, I'm going to let you go. I'm not going to let.
And they're now?
No. In fact, a mob of Michiganders.
Christians?
Other Christians got in boats and attacked the Mormon colony.
Oh, man.
This was, I think, back like in the 1840s or something. In fact, we have, Jerry wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'm still with you, Dennis. Don't hang up. So when Joseph Smith was shot, the Mormons broke off into two factions. One went to Utah. The other went to Beaver Island, Michigan, led by James Jesse Strang, whose son was the last person hanged in public in Albany, New York, for the murder of John Whipple, the husband of a distant cousin of mine.
Wow.
All right. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dennis. So arrive at the argument against gay marriage for me.
Yeah, as a result, right, all those people there, they still hate the Mormons, I mean, even to this day, right? So that's the problem with Romney. I mean, they think he's too liberal, right? And they can't stand him. So okay. it angers all of them because, you know, he's basically going to get the nomination. But in living with these people, what I find is that the argument against it is that, well, it's okay, you know, if they do whatever they do, wherever they do it. But the problem is that we don't want to publicly, like, say it's okay, because then what are we gonna tell our kids, right? Now you can say to your kids, well, hey, you know, some people are a little off. But once it gets endorsed by the government, you basically, you know, what do you explain to your kids? And that's their problem, right?
You think that we ought to take a whole class of people because some people will have difficulty explaining this to their kids. I mean, if it becomes commonplace.
I don't think he thinks this. Oh, I think this is what the Mormons
think. That, but I'm saying.
Oh,
that.
I see. Well,
yeah,
that's
that, guy
that,
think
is, that is, you know what? Fortunately, the people that, you know, in this lawsuit that I was talking about, these plaintiffs who couldn't come up with any real harm the social body would experience, yeah, in California, that wasn't one of them. Yeah, I mean, I've heard that. You know,
what do we tell the kids? Well, you know what? They're going to grow up, and they're going to meet gay people.
Yeah, they say, well, you know, sometimes men love men, and sometimes women love women, and
it's
sometimes
just love.
Men. Yeah, it's.
That's what I would tell my kids.
We should cue a Beatles tune now. Love is.
Yeah.
All right, Dennis, thanks for that. I appreciate it. Here is Dan's in Livonia. Dan, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
We're good.
Good.
I love the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Just got a quick question for you. What difference does it make? I mean, I hear all this anti stuff and whatever, and it's their opinion, but what difference does the gay marriage make?
Well, it doesn't mean.
That's my biggest question.
I would say it's outside of their of a lot of people's comfort zone. They just can't do it. Maybe there's the certain factor of they're uncomfortable with it because maybe they're a little bit gay.
Well, yeah, you know what? I think it is most of it is. I mean, if you're really homophobic, if you know any man that's nutso that hates gays beyond belief, you got to really wonder about you know about whether that is really a repressed homosexuality. I mean, that's the psychoanalytic explanation. But I think most of these people are driven by this religious fervor. And it's very commonplace. We see religious fervor against this group or that group all over the world. I mean, people, these religions have been either, you know, religion to religion or within these religion, you know, they want to kill somebody because they don't think the cousin of the prophet or they don't think that the Pope,
right.
You know, like that.
Their book doesn't agree with the other book,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, that's one reason I'm against organized religion, quote unquote.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, in the good book, doesn't it say to love everybody?
That's what I keep hearing.
Well, there is some. If you ever look at Leviticus, it is pretty nasty what it says to do.
Yeah, the Bible is one of the most brutal books ever written.
The most what book?
Brutal.
Oh, brutal.
Brutal.
Well, mostly in the the Old Testament is pure insanity. Sex and violence. I mean, wasn't I saying in the book of Numbers where God commands the Israelites essentially to do this ethnic cleansing of this tribe that ain't going for his program? You know, I never understood if this guy is the God of the universe, not of Earth, but of the universe, of which there could be millions of inhabited planets and all that. Mm-hmm. Then why does he care whether anybody has any gods before him? I mean, what's his deal? You know
he's
what I mean?
The big god.
I know, but
right?
If he's the big god, you know, you don't care that people might have other gods before you or many gods or.
But he's not judging, right? Is that part of it?
Well, it depends on what part of it. I mean, at least he might think, okay, MF, you don't believe in me? Your ass is going to hell. So what does he care? You know, why can't you, you know, it's not like he's saying, please don't have any other gods before me because it's going to really put you in a bad way. You know, I don't know. I don't get it.
So ridiculous.
I don't get it. All right. Thank you very much, Dan from Livonia. Appreciate it.
And just real quick, we do have a couple of open lines if you want to get in. It's 313-298-9743.
One thing I'm pleased about, and this is we're going to keep talking about religion and gay marriage and all that stuff as well, but I was really pleased to see that there was a front page article, feature in the New York Times today about a generation hobbled by soaring cost of college.
Student loan debt.
Yeah.
And the attempt by these a-holes in Congress who are trying to double the interest rates, you know.
Or allow it to double.
Allow it to double.
To hold it as blackmail against the cutting programs for the poor.
Yeah.
But they tell this story about this young woman in Ada, Ohio, Kelsey Griffith, who, you know what, actually, given the state of things, made a bad financial choice. But here, we were always told, go to college. You want to advance yourself. You want a good income. You want security. Go to college. She goes to college, went to Ohio Northern University, winds up $120,000 in student debt.
What was her degree in?
I don't know. What does it say?
It wasn't journalism, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Now she's working two restaurant jobs.
Yeah.
And Sue's going to have to give her apartment and live with her parents. She has to pay $900 a month on her student loan debt. And remember, too, this is usury. This is wealthy people loaning money to poor people, middle, or not usually the poor, don't go
and
to college,
laughing.
Middle
good
class.
Luck paying that back.
Yeah, they're having a good time.
Yeah.
In 1993, 45% of students wound up with student loan debt. Now, 94% of students who earn a bachelor's degree borrow to pay for higher education.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
I got lucky when my father helped me with that, but now I'm back, I don't really talk about it a lot on the air, but I'm in culinary school because I just can't get it. I can't be a DJ and a talk show host. It's not enough. I've got to be a professional chef too, but I'm taking on some loans now too, Peter. And every time I hear about those interest rates, I get a little itchy, you know?
Sure. You know, I want to talk about where our money's going, but, Steve and Fred and Steve and Marvin and John, hang on 1 minute because we'll go back to what we're talking about. Where our money goes. Get this. The U.S. may scrap costly efforts to train Iraqi police. In the face of spiraling costs and Iraqi officials who say they never wanted it in the first place, the State Department has slashed a multi-billion-dollar police training program that was to have been the centerpiece of a hugely expanded civilian mission there. Now, you know, when we talk about this money being lost, all these people, all these Americans are being hired. And they were going to have about 350 American law enforcement officers. So this is the State Department is going to be paying all these retired police officers to train Iraqi cops.
We're paying for that.
Yeah, you and me.
Our tax dollars.
And these people that are having young people that are being forced to take on this huge debt. The training effort, which began in October, has already cost $500 million. It was conceived of as the largest component of a mission billed as the most ambitious American aid effort since the World War II Marshall Plan. Last year, the State Department embarked on a $343 million construction projects around the country to upgrade facilities to accommodate the police training program. I mean, this is absolutely amazing.
And now they're scrapping that whole thing.
And they were to have comprised hundreds of trainers and more than 1,000 support staff members working in three cities. And,
you know, Iraq started out as a lie. It's always been a disaster, and it's going to continue to be this disaster that is called Iraq.
Yeah. Any of you live
not
in
the country. What we've done to it, especially.
Right. Any of you live in a city where the police are being cut back on? The largest of the Iraq construction projects, an upgrade of the Baghdad Police College that included installing protective covering over double-wide residence trailers and new dining and laundering facilities and seminar rooms, was recently abandoned, unfinished, after an expenditure of more than $100 million.
Why don't you finish it and provide housing for people who have none?
The program has consistently been challenged by the Special Inspector General's Office, which in the audit late last year warned that it could become, quote, a bottomless pit for taxpayer dollars.
Yeah.
So you wonder, why are kids, where are the priorities?
And where are your tax dollars going? I mean, so many people don't even pay one iota of attention to it, don't care, but if you really paid attention, you would be totally pissed off.
Absolutely. Here is, I don't know how we're going to do this, Marvin and John together in Detroit.
Oh, gosh.
Go ahead, guys. What's up?
Hello, Peter.
Yeah, hi.
This is John in Detroit.
Hi, okay. John.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
The lady's name, Susan, I believe? Or
Susan. Yeah, that's me.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
Well, I like that.
I'm going to go by Susan from now on.
Well, actually, the first time I've heard your show, I listened to WRIF. But
This show's been on the air for
what
42 years, and I've been here for 14.
Well, apparently, I don't listen to WRIF on Sunday nights. So.
Well, now you do.
Huh?
Now you do.
Well, this is the first time I'm with my friend that.
All right, but go ahead. One of the things we want to do is move it along.
Yeah, we have a lot of phone
calls. What's your opinion?
Okay, I just wanted to comment on a few statements that were made.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I myself oppose gay marriage.
Why?
And why?
Yeah.
Well,
sorry, I didn't mean to bring that up.
Why?
Because of what it says in the Bible.
What does it say in the Bible?
Can't do it.
It's an abomination. To God.
Okay. Have you ever done anything that someone would consider an abomination?
You got to understand something. It's not that I don't hate people that are gay.
Good. That's big. That's,
not at all. I just don't understand that lifestyle.
It's against the Lord's will.
It what?
That's his buddy in the background. Oh. The peanut gallery.
It's against the will of the Lord.
Okay.
But anyway, no, here's a very important thing. Now, I know you don't believe in God. Here. But anyway, you take a look at the female and the male sex organs, right?
Oh, my. Here we go. Yeah,
well,
do tell.
Isn't that a fact?
Yeah.
We have sex organs, yeah.
Pardon?
Yes, we do have sex
organs. Let me ask you, do you have any tattoos?
Do I have any tattoos?
Yeah.
Why are you saying that, Peter? I have a lot of tattoos.
I don't, but Marvin does.
Well, let me tell you what it says, Leviticus. You shall not make any cuts in your body for the dead, nor make any tattoo marks on yourselves.
Oh, Marvin, you're in trouble.
Peter, I just told you that I don't have those.
John does. He's in a world of trouble.
I'm already in hell, clearly, according to Leviticus.
Anyway, I just wanted to comment on another statement that was made.
Sure.
You were saying that the church or Christian people try to jam their beliefs down your
throat. Some do, not all. Some.
We said not all.
I disagree. You apparently haven't spent much time in church yet. They help a lot of people there.
We understand that, and we.
Okay.
If you listened, though, you would have gotten what we always say. We have both of us have friends, a lot of them. My entire family. Full of Christians, okay? Lovely, wonderful people. When Peter and I protest, we march side by side with some amazing religious activists, mainly in the Catholic Church. So, you know, don't steer the wrong way with our thoughts and what you think our thoughts are. Go ahead.
All right, Marvin and John, you better tell John to get those tattoos removed or it's his ass.
Good night.
I can't find this list.
Your ass is grass, Marvin.
Yeah, and the Lord is the lawnmower. Yeah. I was trying to look while he was talking, this list of things that are prohibited in Leviticus, and, you know, quite a few things. Let's see. Here is Steve in Redford. Steve, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're good.
Great, hi.
What's up?
I've, you know, enjoying the show, listening to everybody and stuff. And I kind of have a little bit off the wall comment and stuff. But, you know, as these gay, you know, rights and communities are rising, I figured maybe there should be some things in place like, you know, they have their own bathrooms and whatnot.
And,
I'm not in support of it, you know, obviously. And I'm not trying to be cynical and whatnot, but honestly, you know,
Isn't that going the other way?
Wait a minute. Can you say that more time?
That maybe gays should have their own bathroom, but how could you tell
Why?
Who is gays?
Why?
I mean, what about all these Republicans?
Do you think they're going to be doing it in the bathroom?
Well, what about all the Republican senators and all that?
That are doing a little airport loving.
Yeah, yeah.
Or trying
where are they going to get that sex? All right, good idea.
Was he serious?
I don't know. I think he said he wasn't.
Okay.
Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, hi. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
What's up, Fred?
Well, I was just calling to let you know it's all about tearing apart the social fabric. That's the biggest excuse against gay marriage, that it's going to disrupt the lives of our children and their children. And you're going to be turning everybody gay. And, well, that's one of the biggest arguments that black clergy makes, you know.
Right. And Fred, you call in.
It's not to be confused for the civil rights movement.
Well, Fred, you call into the show often, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is not what you think.
Oh, no. Well, okay. First of all, unlike the last caller, well, you've heard me say it before, the country is full of morons in the South/Bible Belt.
Yeah.
Who think that the Bible is the end-all of everything or be-all.
Yeah.
Of course, it only came along like a couple of thousand years ago. Half the books are missing. It's highly contradictory to its own self. So, you know, I can't go with fairy tales.
Is it written by a bunch of old white men or something like that?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, no, well... It got co-opted by a bunch of old white men.
So shocking.
A bunch of old Jews.
Yeah, a bunch of brown. They were pretty, yeah.
Right, and then force-fed to everybody else at the point of a Spanish sword or whoever had the weapon of the time.
That's right.
Now, as far as I wanted to say something about Mitt Romney.
Sure.
Now, in and of himself, he's really nothing but, like you said, an opportunist. You know, the presidency is the golden ring. It's the badge.
He wants
it. Like, being a member of the Republican Party, such a big deal for, you know, for white guys.
Right.
Well, Mitt wants that badge.
Yeah, he's a shell. Isn't he just a shell?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty much an empty suit, and he'll flip-flop and say snarky things that sound good to these morons.
Well, let me just interrupt, though, 1 second there, because, you know, he also, I mean, he's not without policy. I mean, he is this man that would probably like to live in a world where businesses like the cutthroat corporations he ran that destroyed companies and fired all these people wouldn't have any regulations. Yeah, Bain Capital. And he would like to, you know, he says he wants to take the regulations off of Wall Street. And we saw what just happened, you know, this $2 billion loss with these banksters. You know, they haven't learned a thing in the last few years, obviously. He has expressed his adversarial view of Russia. I mean, here we are with, you know, putting in this U.S. missile defense system in Eastern Europe, spending billions of dollars on that, with Russia thinking, man,
why are they doing this?
This is aimed at us. And Mitt Romney saying, our big enemy is Russia. So this guy is like 1950s stuff, except Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican president then, was a hell of a lot more liberal, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, sorry,
yeah,
Fred.
Fred, don't you think he's trying to, like, with this Russia thing, he's trying to just stir things up. Let it lie. There's enough war. We don't need to start any more unnecessary wars with any other country in this world.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Fred. We got to go to a break. I was looking. I finally found Leviticus with the book of the Bible.
Yeah, you've been a little busy over there, Peter.
So, so it does say, indeed, that homosexuality is an abomination. But it says, like a lot of other things, are abominations as well. And there are so many things I can't...
No, they just have too many damn rules for me.
There is a lot of rules here.
Too many. I can't do it.
Ye shall not round the corners of your head.
What?
Neither shalt thou mar the corners of thy beard.
What?
Which is, I think, why some of these guys wear long beards.
Okay.
Ye shall not eat anything with the blood, neither shall ye use enchantment nor observe times.
Oh, my gosh.
Regard not them that have familiar spirits, neither seek after wizards to be defiled by them. You know, all this.
Wizards?
I'm trying to find all these rules, though.
These people for real?
Well, it was like a big thing back then. Thou shalt not let thy cattle gender with a diverse kind.
Peter, I can't even take any more of this.
Yeah, and whoever lieth carnally with a woman, that is a bondmaid betrothed to a husband or not at all redeemed, nor her freedom given her, she shall be scourged. They shall not be put to death because she was not free.
So, wait, does the woman get the axe?
Yeah, well, of course.
Or,
yeah.
Okay, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, you know.
I cannot, yeah. Here.
What?
It shall be eaten the same day ye offer. Oh, this is a peace offering. And on the morrow, and it ought remain until the third day, it shall be burnt in the fire. If it be eaten at all on the third day, it is abominable.
What are we eating?
The peace offering. So, in other words, in Leviticus, where these people take their religious condemnation of homosexuality, eating a peace offering on the third day and homosexuality has the same status.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
You
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. This is our final segment. We've got a full load of phones. We'll get to all your calls. Jalene just posted a photograph of me on our Facebook page.
Really good.
One of the few without her.
This is my view every Sunday night. Hey, what are you talking about? Am I a camera hog?
Yeah.
No, I'm not. I include you in every picture of me, Peter. And speaking of the Facebook page.
I'm looking older.
No, you're not.
My beard is gray.
That's the only thing, Peter, you know. Right. And
Facebook.com/nightcall.
And please join us. I got something from Jerry on our Facebook page who wrote in, "Go to Hell" from Alice Cooper would be a fitting song to pay homage to Willard, Mitt Romney. He said, "You'd poison a blind man's dog and steal his cane. You'd even force feed a diabetic a candy cane."
Wow.
Love it. I never remember lyrics.
Alice Cooper supports Romney, though.
He does.
Yeah, he's a Republican.
He plays golf.
that's it.
I should have known.
The girl with the faraway eyes?
What?
The girl with the faraway eyes? Michelle Bachmann? She became a Swiss.
AKA crazy.
She became a Swiss citizen. This is a woman who wanted to be president and was taken seriously by the Republican Party, and then because her husband was Swiss or something like that, and had dual husband is of Swiss descent,
yes,
and is eligible. She was eligible for dual citizenship, so she picked it up, and then she got so much flack from all her patriotic friends, she withdrew it.
Well, she did that within 3 days.
What a trip!
Or 2 days.
Yeah,
She did. She got the Swiss. And then she's going to hold off because she doesn't want people to think that she's anti-American or anything.
Anything like that. By the way, Leviticus tells you all this stuff that you can and can't do. Where is that?
Peter, don't do it to me anymore.
Yeah. What to do if he that hath the issue spit upon him that is clean. What the hell is that? Baby girls are twice as dirty as baby boys. Insects have four legs.
We are not.
Don't look at naked menstruating women. And on.
What? Yeah. That is just awful.
Children who curse their parents, adulterers, and homosexuals must be killed. So that the only thing that these folks hear that cite the Bible is the homosexuals, but the children who curse their parents. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back
same category.
Let's go back and pick these off. Here's Stephen Warren. Steve, thanks for joining us. You're on Night Call. Go ahead.
Is this me?
That's you.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. I'm not opposed to interracial marriage. I'm not opposed to intergender marriage. But when you get to interfamiliar, you legalize family marriage. I can marry my brother. I can marry my sister. Where does that get us?
Well, people have raised the issue.
Now, wait a minute.
No, what he's saying, if there's not some strictures, I mean, every society has rules.
Peter,
what?
In North Carolina, you can marry your dang cousin, but you can't be gay and get married. Do you get the hypocrisy of all this?
Well, yes, but one of the arguments is that if you start softening the rules about who can marry who, it's like that, isn't it nice? I could barely think of his name, Rick Santorum. You'll have man on dog.
Please. You know, like people don't have any self-control. And how often does the cousin on cousin thing happen, really?
Well, people do.
Down in the South.
I know. Hey, up here in Detroit, I know some, you know, from
I actually know
Eastern
someone
Europe.
Who's.
Yeah. I don't know.
Like
I mean, right now, that's not people that are really. Because you could say, why is it illegal for there to be polygamy or polyandry? Why can't a woman have four husbands? Most of them would say one is enough. Yeah.
Yeah, one's enough.
Or why can't a man have five wives if it's consenting people? Why can't a 40-year-old guy marry a 12-year-old girl? You know what I mean? So the idea is once you start softening these very strict rules about adult man and adult woman marrying, then you start to erode the definition. But you know what? That's not on the agenda. And I think it's sort of what do they call that? A straw man. But I appreciate you bringing it up because that's one of the arguments. Thank you. That is one of the arguments.
There we go.
Someone came with an argument.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right.
We're going to give you a, I don't know, imaginary Price.
Here's Amy in Peck. Peck is in Michigan.
Yeah, Sanilac County.
Really?
Welcome.
Okay, welcome.
Small.
Yeah, I guess. So nice. Small, I haven't heard of it.
I've been listening to you guys for a couple years.
Welcome.
I've never
thanks.
Called in yet.
Oh, well, welcome.
Yeah.
I have the answer to all of this, you know, religious problem here.
Oh, good. We're ready.
Love everyone. Embrace everyone. Isn't that what it's supposed to be?
Yeah.
That's what it's supposed to be.
That's what we were told.
Right. And, I mean, I'm a religious person and, you know, a spiritual person, more or less. And we go to a Methodist church, mm-hmm. but I could probably go anywhere and understand what they're talking about. But this whole thing of hatred against the gays and anybody is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. Actually, God would love you guys because you guys love everybody.
See? God
He's
would.
He's totally on your side. He's
you know, I have some real strong Christian friends who, you know, I explained to them that I'm an atheist, the whole thing. But they, for some reason, and I think that's it right there, they just love me. They love me unconditionally as I try to love everybody.
Right, that's what it's about. You know, and the gay marriage thing, okay. I've known people since they were probably 12 years old and younger that ended up being gay, but they were gay when they were kids. You know what I mean? They started that way. It's
well,
not like,
it's genetic.
Right. And of course, everybody's kind of born the same way. You know, you're a baby and you grow up, but all these people, oh, well, so-and-so is gay. Well, you know what? They were gay when they were 6 years old. You know, that's how they were, and that's fine. And I know people that are in their 50s that are, you know, lesbian and they're our best buddies, you know, they're best friends of ours, you know, and just I have a good friend who's 22 or 21 and she just told me this year that she's a lesbian. So what?
Yeah,
and
so
you're
what?
Of, you're boyish when you were 12. So what?
Yeah,
and
I
it
bet
doesn't
you can
change our friendship.
So she's a butch and I mean you can be you don't have to be boyish
fine,
to be a lesbian,
you know,
right?
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
and I'm a married woman, and she know, you know, and we're friends. We're best friends almost.
And
you know,
I bet, let me guess though. I bet she is not attracted to you. I bet she has no interest in breaking up your marriage or anything like that.
I don't ask her about anything. She doesn't ask me about anything. It's just we're good friends.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of rude. I mean, sometimes you know, people that are really close friends can talk about you know their sexual lives, but generally, it's you know, it's not. It's kind of you know. Kind of too much information.
People
do. Oh, yeah, what am I talking about? But Amy, have you ever heard this? I just heard this on the radio the other day. You know, one of the things these conservatives say that you know it's a life lifestyle choice. And this woman said, "Being gay is natural. I can't think of it now. Oh, being anti-gay is a choice. Gay, hating gays. That's what they said. That being gay is natural." Hating gays is a choice.
True.
Right.
Yeah.
True,
well,
true.
My husband's a dairy farmer, and it's funny because when the cows, when they're out there in the pasture and everything, literally, they're all females because they milk. You know, they're all females.
Wait, where are we going with this?
Well, okay, no, it's not going to get
Peter,
bad, but
stop
they will
it.
Literally mount the other female when they're in heat.
Wait,
and
no.
It's just
who mounts the females?
It's a big deal, you know, and it's like,
yeah,
I don't know. What
we're acting like children. We apologize.
You only go around on the planet once, you know. Why live your life in total hatred of everybody? And I'm not saying you guys. I'm saying
we know. And I think it's extremely unhealthy to have all of that hate inside of you. I think it causes disease.
It does. Amy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, bye now. Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that they show on television. These people that have been able to get married, some have been partners for 25, 35 years.
Yeah.
They finally get a legal marriage in Massachusetts or someplace like that.
New York,
Iowa. And they come out and they're smiling, they're happy. And then you have people on the other side, you know, you're an abomination.
Yeah, they have a sign telling them
that
they're sinners.
Yeah.
You know, those.
Who would you rather hang with?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
All
not
right.
The haters.
Let's get Sharon in Windsor. Sharon, thanks for making our show international. Welcome. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Sharon.
Yeah. Hi. Well, my opinion basically is sexuality, it's a personal, private matter. You know, whether you're gay or whether you're straight. And I
or
guess
bi or
point,
whatever.
Yeah, or whatever you are. And to me, I guess you said this sort of humorous thing earlier about religion. You know, it's like a penis. It's
don't shove it. You know,
what is it? Yeah, you've got it. You can be proud of it. But
Peter, what is it?
It's okay to have one.
It's okay to
be proud of it.
But don't
shove it down people's throats.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel that way about I guess the whole gay movement or whatever it is. I'm not sure if I should say the movement, but I don't have anything against someone for being gay if they're decent and it's consenting adults. I don't have anything against someone being bi or straight or whatever. But, you know, I don't. To me, maybe I'm an older generation or maybe it's my personal way, but it's private. I think it just.
But they should be able to.
They should be able to be
free to function in society as.
Yeah, I mean, there's
a
gay rights movement only because there's people.
There has to be one.
Yeah, I mean, how else would people get their rights if it was left up to
can
the?
You have the right to be gay. It's a personal thing. You have your relationships as you choose to have them. It's not illegal. It's not.
She's such a polite Canadian.
Yeah, well, you know what? It actually was illegal in the States here. They had laws, what they called sodomy laws, just till recently. Sort of like I was saying earlier, they had laws against blacks and whites marrying up till 1967. Well, the law that finally the Supreme Court saying that the state didn't have any right to regulate behavior like that, as you said, Sharon, between consenting adults, I think this came down in the early 1990s. But, I mean, the reason that, you remember that, I guess it was in the 1960s, I don't know, remember, or read about, there was what they call the Black Pride Movement, and, you know, James Brown said,
right.
I'm black and I'm proud and all of this. And you'd say, whoa, I mean, white people, they're making a big thing out of race. Well,
They kind of had to.
It was necessary to say, look, I'm a human being. And once people say, yeah, it's not an issue anymore in skin color and sexuality and gender and all that, doesn't make any difference, well, then all of this will stop. But as long as there are these people that are opposing what you're saying, you know, correctly, is only an individual's right, you're going to have this kind of commotion about it in this public tumult. And remember, this is all caused by people that do not want democratic rights extended. I mean, they've got, I guess the only reason is against the Bible, and that doesn't make it in a secular, you know, Canada's a secular country as well. But let me move on. I want to thank you so much for calling,
yeah.
Sharon. Appreciate it, from Windsor. And here's Jamie. Jamie, hi, you're on the air. Where are you calling from? Hey, Jamie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wake up, Jamie.
I'm sorry, I didn't know it was me.
It's from Detroit.
Oh, Detroit. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I was just calling in. This is my first time listening to your show. You guys are great.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, no problem. But anyway, I'm 24. I've got, you know, lots of gay friends, lots of straight friends. And, you know, I don't know if this really ties into exactly what you guys were saying. But, you know, from talking to people, I don't really see an end to this whole, you know, anti-gay thing, whatever,
right.
for at least, you know, a number of years.
For at least ever? Think about racism, you know?
Right. And, you know, I think it'll always be there to some effect, but this might sound kind of morbid, but we're kind of waiting for, you know, the Romneys and all these old white guys to just die. You know?
Thinning of the herd.
Yeah, you know, just get it all out of there. I mean, it's always going to be around. Their kids are going to be influenced by them and everything, but I think that's real strong, you know, hatred towards gay people, or at least I'm crossing my fingers that some of it dies with them. You know?
Well, you would hope so, but I mean, think if you were 24 in 1965 or 1966, right in the middle of the civil rights movement, and you're thinking, man, all these historic figures, the George Wallaces and the Bull Connors, if you remember any of this stuff, and Lester Maddox, who tried to stop blacks from coming into his restaurant with axe handles and stuff like that. The, you know, the Freedom Riders, who integrated buses and were met by these mobs.
Amazing.
But you'd say, man, I can't wait till all these old white guys die off and all of that. And here it is coming back, these people getting so nuts just because you have a guy with a darker hued skin being the president of the United States.
Yeah,
you know?
These people have lost their minds.
Well, yeah, I mean,
really.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. And one of the things people always say among the younger generation, that you just don't have that kind of rigidity about those old categories.
I think it's true. You know, I see it with my niece and nephew, and they're just like whatever. And you know, these, but the thing that's scary is these old white guys have kids. And the,
well, that's what, yeah,
and,
that's
and
what
then grandkids.
Jamie said.
Yeah.
Right.
But
very, very true.
But you know what? You're living in a city like Detroit, and I mean, it's important. I just live a little outside and spend most of my time, my social time, out, you know, inside the city of Detroit. And when you do that, and when you have a diverse community, those things begin to evaporate. And you see, like I said a little earlier, a range of behavior, and you're friends with people on how they react to you. And you couldn't care less the color of their skin, their gender, their sexual preference. So what? You know?
Just a big whatever.
Yeah, it does.
Right.
Well, all right, Jamie, I want to thank you very much. I appreciate it. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, too. That was the first time, he said. Let's see. Here is Sam. Sam's in Mount Clemens. Sam, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
We love that.
What you call it? I heard an interesting comment on the news. A man said it was a biological imperative with 7 billion people in the world.
There you go.
Human population, more and more people are becoming gay because it's nature's way of keeping us from overpopulating ourselves, perhaps.
You know, there I have heard that before.
Oh,
well,
God.
No, that it's adaptive, as you know, the phrase goes, and because we are severely, I mean, people don't really, you know, understand that
how overpopulated.
Yeah,
the
I mean,
world is
4 or 5 thousand years ago, we were just one species among the many. Now we
fewer kids is very good, I think.
Yeah,
I'm not having any.
In the year 1800, there was 1 billion people. By 1900, there were 3. And here we are in 2000, a little past, and we have 7 billion people.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm a Christian who believes in the natural evolution of the universe. So, you know.
But it seems to me that argument is saying that that these, you know, these gay people, these cast-offs, you know, do you know what I'm saying?
No, you know what it is?
It seems like negative to me.
That the species itself, it begins to adapt to the population's
pressure.
But gay people
can have babies, too. I mean, that's the thing.
Well, they can, but they usually don't.
Yeah, they do.
I don't know what the stats are. I know.
There are so many women who are lesbians who have a boatload of kids.
Yeah.
Okay. I know gay men who adopt kids. You can, you know.
Well, we got to get the stats on it.
Well, let's get the stats, Peter. Let's call the Triangle Foundation.
All right, Sam. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thanks, Sam.
It. Bye. Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever heard that one.
I have. I don't think it had much of an impact on population.
Yeah.
But whatever reason, I mean, listen. I love kids. I love people that have children.
Sure.
I love little babies.
Love them. So
but
cute.
We're heading towards a bad point,
right.
With this many folks.
Yeah, you and I are doing our part to not add to that.
That's right. But you and I separately.
Separately. Right. We always have to clarify
we,
that.
We so, use birth control, but with not with each other.
Right. It's funny how many people through the years have thought, we went to the Martin Luther King rally together, and this guy said to me, remember we went to that?
I mean, Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this guy came up and introduced himself to me, and he said, yeah, you guys are married, right? Like, no.
How about when we were in the airport in Washington, D.C.?
And we saw your friend.
Saw my friend, and he said,
who's the blonde?
Yeah. He, Peter, hi. And he says,
And you are.
Yeah. And he goes, you know, my wife, who never wants to have her name mentioned on the air.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She, you know, she kiddingly around, you know, started calling herself Kiki.
Yeah, I love that.
Maybe we should call her Kiki.
I think that's her new name.
Yeah.
Let's just not even tell her we're calling her that,
right.
She'll get mad at us.
All right. Here's Anthony in Trenton. Anthony, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing tonight? I'm a first-time caller myself.
Right
welcome.
On, welcome.
Mm-hmm, thank you. I just had a comment, you know, that we were talking about this the other day, that, like, a lot of these guys are out there having sex with different girls, and they're having children.
Yeah.
And a lot of these guys are a father to 2 and 3 children at a time. Now, what happens if these children meet later on, 18 years later, and was it incest that they might have? You know, that is you know,
no.
I don't like to even.
You're thinking too hard, buddy.
You know, I actually read about. Did you read this thing in the case where this woman who had had a kid when she was like 14 went and seduced her son purposely?
Oh, come on. What? Come on.
But you know what? Yeah, I mean, Anthony, I think Celine's right. You're thinking too much. Yeah, yeah. All right, we're almost out of time, so let me see.
Chill the brain.
I want to real quickly get Sammy, and he's listening in Indiana. Where are you listening in Indiana?
I'm driving down 94 right now.
Okay.
Truck driver.
Indiana. But
you called before.
No. This is actually the first time.
Okay.
Go ahead.
First time I heard the show and first time I called. But even though I may not believe in it, I'm not going to sit here and judge somebody else because they want to be like that. I mean, yeah, the Bible may say, you know, God made Adam and Eve, but if they believe, you know, if that's who they love, then that's who they love.
Hey, Adam and Steve have a damn good time. I can tell you that.
Right. I don't even know what they say.
Yeah. God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
Right. All right, Sammy, thanks for catching us. I got to go. Got one more caller to go, and then we're out of here.
Yes.
Dominic in Redford. Dominic, hi, you're on the air. Real quickly, just got a few secs.
All right.
SECs. Yeah.
I got a funny comment that somebody gave to me this weekend. Was I was talking to one of my friends, and he said the only reason people should be getting married is to have kids.
Yeah.
Like, he's trying to repopulate the earth on his own. He already has 4 within the last, like, 5 years.
Wow.
But
he's been busy.
His wife got her tubes tied. So I wanted I thought it was funny that he said that because his wife can't have kids anymore. So I asked him if they should get a divorce.
There you go.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Come up with an answer.
Yeah, well.
Of course he couldn't.
He probably lost a friend.
Doing stupidity.
One of the things, Dominic, that's going on, and it came about with this recent election in France, is...
Where Sarkozy lost.
Yeah, and
the socialist won.
Hollande isn't married to his companion, and they're wondering whether they can go to some Muslim countries and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
But the whole, you know, all of Europe is beginning not to have, marriages.
Right.
There are some advantages. I mean, with Social Security.
Yeah, you know what the advantage is?
What?
To not being married?
What?
Not being married.
Okay, there you go.
Hey, listen,
Dominic, thanks for being our last caller. I appreciate it.
I'm off to Chicago to do some serious
protesting.
Oh,
man, we should have
talked about it earlier, but I'm going to be there from Wednesday through Sunday, essentially. I'm coming back in the middle of it's craziness because I'm crazy. But I will be at the big anti-NATO protest on Sunday. I will be here in time to do Night Call next Sunday night.
And are you going to bring?
And I'm bringing David Rovics with me.
Singer-songwriter.
And he is going to tell us about his big tour in Europe. What's going on? He can tell us all about austerity. He can tell us everything that's going on in Europe and how Europeans are viewing us. I think that's important. And
absolutely.
Just in general about what's going on in the world. He's got his pulse on it as much as we do.
Sarah and Athena in the other room making this all happen from there. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, and like us. Leave some comments.
Sure.
And
we'll have a podcast up for you tomorrow.
Have a great week.
By noon.
Today.
Today.
By noon. Oh, no, wait a minute. Tomorrow. You're right.
Okay.
Next week, hey?
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
This Friday, starting at 5 p.m., is the RIF Rock Girl Finals Bash at the Hard Rock Cafe downtown. Join Meltdown and Screamin' Scott broadcasting live. Free admission to catch Adelita's Way. The CD release celebration for Detroit's own Pistol Day Parade. Then, help WRAF welcome your choice as the new 2012 Riff Rock Girl. That's this Friday starting at 5 p.m. at the Hard Rock Cafe, 45 Monroe Street, downtown Detroit. Get all the details online at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, we're entering the dreadful election season. I say dreadful because it just stretches on and on and on and on. And each party looking for its advantage. And we're told that the main, and this is probably true, the main concern of Americans is the economy. And some people have said that the Republicans are the party that broke it and the Democrats are the party that can't fix it. And every time something comes out, like a jobs report or something like that, each party says, see, that proves our point. You know, the Democrats can't fix it. Or the Democrats say, see, it's getting better. Well, let's try to get with someone who has a fix on all of this and goes beyond all the political rhetoric. He's Richard Wolff, and I've interviewed him before. He put out a book called Capitalism Hits the Fan. You can remember that phrase with another word in there. And that was right at the beginning of the Bush recession depression. And Richard D. Wolff is a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts. He's currently visiting professor at the New School University in New York. He's been a guest on NPR. Glenn Beck, I'm going to ask him about that. And Amy Goodman's Democracy Now. So he's, wide-ranging in who he is, who he's talking with. The book is called, new book, it's called Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. We're going to maybe even do more with that subtitle. And it's a conversation with David Barsamian. And let's welcome back to the Peter Werby Show, Richard Wolff. Greetings. Thanks for joining me again.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, when we last talked, remind me, when did Capitalism Hits the Fan hit the press or hit the public?
Just at the turning point between 2009 and 2010.
Okay, things were really in the toilet, and that fits with the analogy there. Things have gotten better, right?
Well, it depends on your perspective. In some ways, they've gotten a bit better in the sense that when the book came out, that Capitalism Hit the Fan, we were looking at unemployment rates in the neighborhood of 10%, and today we're looking at unemployment rates in the neighborhood of a little over 8%. So from that perspective, from the depths of the downturn, we're not as bad off as we are now. The trouble is, when you look a little closer at all such statistics, the thing gets muddier, to say the least. Before this recession hit, and the official start we should all remember is the December of 2007, at that point, before the crisis hit, our unemployment rate was 5%. So if that's your benchmark, then today being at over 8% certainly doesn't qualify for anything like a recovery. We haven't even made it halfway back to where we were before the crisis hit. And if you think about what it means year after year that millions of our fellow citizens have no work, and that they've used up their savings, they're now a burden to their families and friends, they can't support the services in their communities. You have a spreading economic malaise, which makes it perfectly reasonable, I think, that Americans are looking at this election with the economy on their minds.
Well, so frequently, and I always think about Latin America, there'd be a conservative party and a liberal party, and they'd vote the conservative party in, and then they would not do very well for the ordinary people. Then they get the liberal party in, and they wouldn't do very good. They go, okay, we got to go back to the conservatives. And but in your book and the answers you give to David Barsamian and Occupy the Economy, you see it as a fundamental question of the way our economic structure or the way our economic system is structured.
Yes, and I think your way of putting it is really good. I think all around the world, people are becoming fed up with the kind of musical chairs alternation between a little bit more conservative, a little bit more liberal, precisely because neither of them seems to be able to deal with at least the extent of the kinds of problems we have. And I think there's a reason for that. I think that what has happened is we've wanted, and it's understandable, to look at the economic problems the United States has as though they were specific, limited, just about home mortgages or just about student loans or just about jobs going overseas. And sometimes it makes sense to look at these kinds of problems individually, each one by itself. But then there comes a time when you have to face the fact that all of the different parts of a system are now not working anymore. It's a little bit like that sad moment when you've called the refrigerator repair person to your home, and he looks sadly at you and says, look, I can replace the condenser, or I can redo the cooling section over here, but I've got to tell you honestly, it probably isn't worth it because the thing is now 30 years old. It's had a good run, and everything is beginning to crumble. I want people to take a step back and look at a system that is now troubled on so many fronts that we can't deal with one particular issue. We have to deal with the system as a whole. And it's hard. We are not used to it. In our country, we have spent the last 50 years thinking that questioning capitalism was some kind of disloyalty or some kind of strange or crazy thing. So we're not used to it. But I think we have to get over that problem. I think we have to realize that just as Americans are proud of having questioned and debated their education system, their medical insurance system, their energy and ecological systems, we're past due to question an economic system that is now delivering such difficulties to so many parts of our society.
Richard Wolff is my guest. His book, Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. And as people, I'll just say this as an aside, people know that anytime I interview anyone in New York City, you at least once hear a siren in the background.
Yes, I'm sorry about
that. No, that's
that.
Okay. This is a standard for my guests in New York City. That's okay. It's an ongoing kind of joke. Well, capitalism never was established very easily. I mean, there were riots against it in the 18th century. Some would even put it back further. All sorts of opposition from the Luddites in England all through the 19th century, the 20th century. And yet the systematic philosophies that opposed it, communism, socialism, anarchism, were always thought to be, and particularly communism, to be real bad alternatives. Because what happened within those is that it proposed to have a fairer economic system, but enforced it with a police state. And you speak to that in Occupy the Economy. So what speak a little about the opposition to capitalism, maybe even a little historically, but how do we stay away from the cops wanting to manage our economy?
No, absolutely. And the American people should not in any way shy away from questioning socialism and communism every bit as much, if not more, than the system that we have. I think you raise a very important point. Capitalism existed in the world in little bits and pieces here and there, but never became the basic economic system in the world until about 300 years ago. In Britain in the 18th century and in France in the 19th century, there were bloody revolutions, the British and French revolutions in those centuries, that got rid of the old system that was crumbling, feudalism, and replaced it with this new one, capitalism. And many of the early decades of capitalism were pretty ugly to look at. I mean, go back and take a look at the novels of Charles Dickens or the novels of Emile Zola in those two countries, and you will see descriptions of society that would have made any reasonable person say, my goodness, we went through a revolution to get a system that is, if anything, making people worse off than it was before. So there really is nothing new under the sun, in the sense that the early efforts, like the Soviet Union or People's Republic of China and so on, the early efforts to go beyond capitalism were a mixed bag. They made some progress, and they also made some disastrous errors that have to be learned from. We have to learn from what they achieved. We have to learn from what they didn't do well. One of the key things they didn't do well, as you allude to, is concentrating way too much power in the hands of the government relative to the average citizen. So that's clearly a no-no. No one's going to go in that direction again who wants to do better than capitalism, because we learned bitterly what the dangers along that line are. But it doesn't make sense to look at some of the efforts to go beyond capitalism, find serious flaws in them, and then give up the effort. That's as if people who had established capitalism after feudalism looked at some of the results, drew the conclusion these were really not what we wanted, and then gave up the effort. I think we would all be sad if that had ever happened. And I think, therefore, we have to now say to ourselves, an economic system is only as good as the results it delivers to the people who live in it.
Well, we still have a culture, though, in which people, I would think even today, take it, one of the key ideas of capitalism is that we can all make it if we try, if we get the right education, if we're smart enough, if we have enough perseverance, and that it's not really rooted in the system itself, but maybe it does need some tinkering. We've got to put the lid on these banksters in terms of regulations, that we have to make education more available to people, and on and on. I mean, throwing, and although you're not saying to throw the baby out with the bathwater, it sounds like that. Where's the middle ground?
Well, I think that we have to face pretty unpalatable realities. When the Occupy movement hit its stride last October and November, they put forward a slogan, which was thought daring at the time, that America is a society splitting into the 1% at the top and the 99% who really can't make it anymore and are in ever-deepening economic distress. I think the reason it hit such a responsive nerve is that we're all finding that that's true about our lives. I'm an academic, and I see it, for example, in the following, that we now have an entire generation of students who are basically facing a terrible job prospect, who decide to go back to school to get more credentials, more degrees, so they have a better shot at a decent job. They discover that another part of the economy, meanwhile, has spun out of control, namely the cost of going to college and university has risen much faster than the standard of living of most Americans. So in order to get the degree they need to find a job, they have to borrow tens of thousands of dollars, ending up with a college degree and huge debts, only to discover that even with the college degree, either the job will elude you or the kind of income that you had hoped the job would pay doesn't happen to be the case, and you're looking down the road at a mediocre job future carrying levels of debt that will encumber you even in the most basic human decisions about whether you get married, whether you have children, and so on. That's a dysfunctional system. We're unfortunately beyond the point where we can get angry at bankers and pass a law about them or do something about college tuition. It's too much of an integrated system. And again, to use the metaphor, it's like a doctor saying to you, this is not a problem that can be solved by some ointment over here or a pill over there. We've got to do some basic work because the system, the entirety of your body, its chemistry, its structure, have a serious set of problems, and we can think we can deal with them, but we're going to have to do something pretty serious, something even, if I dare use the word, radical. And I'm afraid, you know, having not debated capitalism, having felt that our job was to celebrate it and never to question it or criticize it in any systematic way for 50 years, we have the results that doctors tell us we're going to get if we don't look carefully at our ailments along the way, catch them when they're young, catch them when they're not yet too developed, when we have a better shot at dealing with them. We haven't done that with our system. We have dealt with critics of capitalism as if they were pariahs or not to be listened to. And so we're now paying the price in an economic system that isn't going to be fixed. I mean, let me give you the best example I can.
Sure.
In the 1930s, our banking system was deemed full of banksters, just like we do today. And we passed very stringent rules, regulations, and limits. After the Great Depression passed, those same banks, having been left alone as economic institutions, went to work to use the money they collected in their vaults to undo all of the regulations and rules that had been passed to control them. And they succeeded. If all we do in the face of the current crisis is write and impose a new crop of rules and regulations, we really will have only ourselves to blame when the banks do again what they've proven to us they will do the last time around.
Hmm. My guest is economist Richard Wolff. His book is Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. It's published by City Lights Books, and you can go to R.D. Wolff with two Fs, rdwolff.com. There is just so much of, you can hook onto this book. There's a lot of Richard Wolff's writings, videos, everything you need to know about the economy. I'll have a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. You use the word radical. There also is the phrase radical reforms. You were talking about education. Here's a radical reform, and I don't know if this challenges capitalism or not. You have a jubilee for students. You relieve all student debt. You make all universities free. You cut the war budget in half. Boom. Problem solved. And you still got capitalism, and, although the people holding the debt wouldn't be very happy, maybe you can have the government compensate them for it. But you take the burden off our young people and our future. There is a reform. I don't know if that you would consider that challenging capitalism or not.
Sure, I would, but I would stress to you that the hardest thing about such a reform, putting aside accomplishing it, which would be hard enough.
Absolutely.
In our society. But putting that aside for the moment, how would you then face the people who explain to you it's wonderful that you relieved the debt of the student, but let me show you how I've used my credit card to sustain my family through a very difficult time, not of our making, to put together the money to start a small business that has been successful and has allowed me to send my kids to college and so on. Why are you not relieving my credit card debt? Or the person who had no choice but to buy a car because the distance between where he or she lived and worked was so far and our public transportation system so poor that the only way they could avoid unemployment was to have a car to do the commuting to their job, and they borrowed the money for that car as they had to. Why are they not being helped? Why are the countless people being thrown out of their homes through foreclosure not being helped? You know, if you start the process, which I would support, of really thinking radically about levels of debt that are no longer supportable, here's what you discover, and it illustrates my point. We are now an economy mired in debt. The government has over $15 trillion in debt. Private corporations have borrowed like never before. Individuals are racking up credit card debt, mortgage debt, car payment debt, student debt now on a scale we've never seen before. This is an economy riven by debt, and once you kind of lift the rock up and you see the network of debts that we have, then you begin to discover this is not a problem that lends itself to being relieved by abolishing a debt over here or a little one over there or even a big one over there, because the whole economy is the problem. It has been unable to solve its problems, to work out the economics of a business, of the government, of a family, in a way without going into now interwoven debts. And I haven't even mentioned the entire world of finance, credit default swaps, asset-backed securities, this enormous set of paper products that are dependent on the underlying indebtedness of the population. By this time, it literally is a house of cards. And once you want to fix one part of it, you really do risk bringing the entire edifice down around you. That's why we have to face it as a systemic problem.
Richard Wolff, as usual, you've nailed it. I suspected, and even, I even had that that sense when you answered my question, that what's an individual to do? I mean, these are forces, either anonymous forces of the market that no one seems to have control over. It's, I forgot whose phrase it was, things are in the saddle and ride mankind, or that organized economic and political forces within society that are so powerful that the lone individual is powerless. I mean, how? And I would say, man, I just hope I don't get screwed too badly. I mean, that could wind up, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I understand it. I get that question a great deal, and it's a perfectly good and reasonable question. And I think, again, we have to be real honest because we've run out of the chance of self-delusion. The individual isn't going to be able to do this. It's perfectly rational for an individual to say, in the face of all that's going on around us, I'm going to do my level best with those closest around me to try to make sure that as the tornado flies by, I don't get hit in the head with a chair, you know, that I'm going to save myself, I'm going to try to escape the worst of it, and so on.
Could I just interrupt you to say that's what people in every horrible slum in the third world say as well? So people, you know.
Absolutely.
Okay, go ahead, sorry.
Absolutely. And that's what, you know, Americans said in the worst days of our lives as a colony of Great Britain before people figured out, you know, there are only so much you can do as an individual to escape. Maybe the better strategy is not to figure out how to escape a disaster, but actually get together with other people who are trying to figure out an escape and discover that together the force of a movement or of a large organization can begin to actually change the problem rather than forever trying to figure out an escape from it. And I think the signs of that happening are everywhere. I mean, last Sunday, there were two very important elections, one in the country France, the other one in the country Greece. And in both those elections, the mass of people surprised the political establishment by basically saying the conventional parties that exchange positions with one another, like musical chairs, a little more liberal this time, a little more conservative the next time, we're done with that. We're pushing you all out of the picture. We now want people who have much bolder ideas, much more radical proposals. We used to be afraid of them, but now we're more afraid of what you people keep repeating is normal and working its way out because it's happening at our expense. And so they said no more austerity, no more cutting everything in the face of an economic disaster. We want you to do the opposite. We want you to make life better for us, not to tell us that we have more suffering to undertake. And I think that's a sign, just as the Occupy movement in this country and the speed with which it got mass sympathy in this country last autumn is another sign that the mood and the perspective of the American people is shifting. And one last thing about it. It's our history, our American history that Americans really don't know so well, that should give us hope. In the 1930s, we had a depression much worse than this one. Unemployment in 1933 was 25%. That's three times what it is today. We had mass loss of people's homes. We had governments that had no money at all. And in the middle of that Great Depression, worse than we have now, suddenly, masses of people organized in trade unions, the CIO, they organized in socialist and communist parties, and they said something has to change in this country big time. And the president of the United States at that time, Franklin Roosevelt, turned around 180 degrees, turned on a dime. And in the midst of a depression when there was so-called no money, what did he do? He created Social Security for the first time for elderly Americans. He created the unemployment compensation system for unemployed Americans for the first time. And he created and filled 12.5 million jobs between 1934 and 1940 so that the unemployed would get work. Suddenly, when the chips were down, all that talk about what we can't do, what we can't afford, was chucked out the window, and the Americans knuckled down and got out of the depression, at least the worst of it, far better than people in many other countries who were not able or willing to make a radical break of the sort that Roosevelt did. And let's remember, that did not cost him politically. That was not what pundits today say, politically impossible. On the contrary, that was so popular that Roosevelt went on to win four consecutive presidential elections. No president had ever done that before in American history, and it so freaked out the Republicans that they got a law passed after Roosevelt died to limit the terms to two. But he was the most popular president in the world and arguably the most radical when it comes to economics.
Richard Wolff, in about, can you do this in 60 seconds, you were a guest on the Glenn Beck Show. I would have thought he would have had you up on his blackboard as being one of the enemies of America.
On the contrary, Glenn Beck was very respectful, was very polite. I have nothing to reproach him for. He called me to be on his program. I went on his program. We did about an 8 or 9 minute interview. You can get the transcript of it on my website, rdwolf.com. He was incensed that rich private universities like Harvard and Yale do pay no taxes to the communities in which they exist, imposing therefore much higher taxes on the people who live there. He's absolutely right about that. I agree with him. He agrees with me. We set aside our differences about capitalism. He likes it. I don't much. And we went to work analyzing that problem using Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut as the example where I got my PhD, so I know that place. And his mother-in-law lives there and works for the university, so we knew all about it. And we together presented what I thought was a very thoughtful critique of the American system of allowing billion-dollar universities to get free public services in communities that cannot afford them.
Incredible. I would have thought different fiery, but you know, it's good to find points of agreement. The book is Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. It's economist Richard Wolff in conversation with David Barsamian, and it's published by City Lights Books. You can go to citylights.com to get all of the material to buttress what we've been talking about here, including the book. You can go to Richard Wolff's website. It's rdwolff with two Fs, rdwolff.com. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Richard Wolff, as always, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thank you very much, and my hat's off to you for having conversations like this available to the public.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Social Security, it's in the news a lot. People debating whether it's solvent, whether it even should exist. You know, shouldn't these individuals be out on their own, even though they're 87? But in any event, it's something that is in all of our lives, no matter what your age is, right? And number of people on it are disabled, and other people, of course, mostly get it after, in their 60s. But what the concern is this going to be something that's going to continue to function in the manner that it has over the last number of decades? And I was looking at a New York Times article from April 23rd, and I thought, uh-oh. It says Social Security's financial health worsens, and it talks about this report that said, whoa, the trust fund will be exhausted in 2033. That may sound like a long time away, but time flies. But then I was looking at some other articles. One was in Common Dreams, and it said, contrary to mainstream myth, Social Security is strong and could be made stronger. Well, okay, that contradicts it. Also, in BuzzFlash.com, forget the scary headlines. Social Security has more than $2.7 trillion surplus. What is one to think? How do we figure this out? Fortunately, a book has come along right at this time to enter the debate at a perfect time. It's called The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. It's a sweeping history and account of Social Security. It's written by Eric Larson. And Eric Larson is an independent financial and political journalist, activist, and commentator. He's been a staff writer for Corporate Finance Magazine, and he was editor of Asset International. He's written for publications like Z Magazine and The Nation, Institutional Investor, and CFO, and knows what he's talking about. And the I was going to mention something, but I'll ask him when we after we welcome him. He's in Buckland, Massachusetts right now, in Western Massachusetts. Eric Larson, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
You know, I was I knew this was coming, and I expected I was going to think like a 175 page book. We wind up with an 800 page book from AK Press. The first question is very obvious. There's that much to say about Social Security?
Yeah, there is. Social Security's been maybe the biggest domestic issue ongoing for the last 30 years in this country. It's an incredibly important program. It's an income support for millions of elderly people. It keeps over 20 million people a year out of poverty. That is not just elderly people. That's disabled. That's children of deceased workers. We're trying to stay in school. It's an incredibly important program, and it's been under attack from the right and the center right really for almost the entirety of the last 30 years. Every president since Jimmy Carter has tried to cut Social Security somehow, and a year doesn't go by in which it's not a major issue. So there's a lot of history there, and it's worth knowing because of the important part it plays in people's lives. And also because the debate is still going on, it's very likely after the election this year that it'll come up again in terms of the negotiations between Republicans and Democrats over what to do about the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, for example. How do we pay for this? Do we use Social Security as a way to extract more money to pay for those cuts, for example?
Well, it's interesting. You said every president over the last 30 years, and
yes.
At the beginning you said it was under attack from the right, but the Democratic presidents have been examining it, if you will, as well, correct?
Yeah, and that's because the center right, who I'd consider, you know, the more conservative members of the Democratic Party, has been pretty consistently in favor of cutting Social Security all along as well. So this is going right back to Jimmy Carter, who was sort of the original new Democrat, sort of center right Democratic leader. This goes back a long ways, and so it's really been kind of a grassroots coalition of progressive lawmakers on the Democratic side, labor unions, advocates for the elderly, that's come together every time Social Security has been attacked and has had to defend it. So, and that's part of really the remarkable political story that I try and tell in The People's Pension, is how that coalition keeps forming and reforming and defending this thing, which is so important for so many people.
In your incredible, comprehensive book, The People's Pension, Eric Larson, you talk about a plan that was actually put together by Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, of all people, that would have altered Social Security. Now, that was a real shocker. Give us the story of that.
Well, this happened during Clinton's second administration, and the budget had been balanced for the first time in decades. And a lot of Clinton's advisors, he was really what you'd call a new Democrat. He was a sort of a center-right president, as you know, despite what you hear from the far right, that's essentially what he was. And he felt that it was he was looking for legacies, something he could do that would put his name in the history books. And he felt that resolving Social Security's fiscal issues for the foreseeable future would be the way to do it. And he had a partner, sounds unlikely, but he did, in Newt Gingrich, who was interested in being a statesperson, being behind big legislation. And they got an effort going, very hush-hush, to put together a plan that would have essentially cut Social Security benefits and set up private accounts on the side so that you'd get less benefits over time, but you would be allowed to save some money in a private investment account, which would give you a chance to build your benefits back up. And they came very close to concluding a deal like this. In fact, what a lot of people don't know is that even after the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke, and the relationships between Republicans and the White House became very, very frosty. It became almost impossible for them to work together. Clinton and Gingrich were so eager to do this deal that they kept that effort going up for quite a few months after the scandal broke. And it was only at a certain point when the Democratic delegation in Congress became very solidified against it that the president and the speaker had to give up.
Now, other than a few libertarians who don't think there ought to be any government programs whatsoever and people ought to depend either on their own resources, or heard somebody yesterday say that it could all go to private charity, even the most severe critics of Social Security, people that want to alter the nature of it and all that, they all agree that there ought to be something that's there for our elderly and our disabled and other people in situations that need assistance. However, and I began the broadcast with this, saying that the problem is that it's about to go bankrupt. Another few years and it's going to go away. There won't be enough money to pay out what is owed. And yet, on the other hand, there's all these, there's two reports. One, as I said, the headline, Social Security's financial health worsens. Others say, forget the scary headline. Social Security has more than $2.7 trillion surplus. What are we to make of this?
Well, there's a lot of misconceptions about the trust fund and about what Social Security does. Social Security depends on a number of things to stay healthy financially. There's a large trust fund, which is supposed to ensure that there's enough assets to cover benefits payments for decades to come. That trust fund is made up of two things. It's made up of ART payroll tax contributions, the FICA line on your paycheck. Part of that goes into the Social Security Trust Fund. It's used to pay current benefits, and whatever's left over builds up the fund. There's also that fund earns interest. So the federal government pays interest because what the fund is invested in is treasury bonds. Those earn interest. Federal government chips in that money, and that's where you get the trust fund. Now, the estimates that that Social Security puts out every year tell us how far into the future the program is solvent. In other words, how far into the future the trust fund can cover future payments. 10 years ago, that date, the end date was 2042.
Mm-hmm.
As of this year, it's 2033. So why is it so much closer than it was? Why isn't it 75 years into the future, which is what it's supposed to be, which is what it was designed to be? Well, there's a couple reasons. Critics of Social Security like to point to two things. The baby boomers retiring, big wave of retirees, and number two, not enough new people, new workers entering the market, low birth rates and so forth. Actually, it's true that these things are happening, But number one is this was anticipated. The baby boom happened a long time ago, and it's been predicted for a long time that this would happen. The trust fund was still supposed to extend 75 years into the future. The reason it doesn't has more to do with another thing that's happened in the past few decades, which is, I can say it in two words, wage stagnation.
Sure.
Ever since the early 70s, and except for a brief spurt in the late 90s, we've experienced stagnation of real wages in this country. The 1% have done very well, but average people have not seen their wages rising. This was not anticipated. If wages had kept rising the way they were in, the way they would have done under historical circumstances, the Social Security Trust Fund would be in good shape. It might need a little tweaking here and there, but basically it would be in pretty good shape and we wouldn't have to be having this debate. So if you want to know the real reason there might be a problem with Social Security in the future, it's because of the fact that our economy has gone through a really brutal restructuring since the 70s. People aren't making the money they used to make. It's been much, much harder to get to force raises through. Organized labor has been weakened, outsourcing, globalization. All of these things have contributed to stagnating wages, and that's the real issue here.
The book is The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. My guest is the author, Eric Larson. It's published by AK Press. You can go to akpress.org, which is an incredible publisher, terrific books. And you can also Google People's Pension, and you'll get Eric Larson's blog. I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com as well. And this is a critical issue to all of us. You know, when we look at Social Security and what's coming in terms of income, most of us know that there's a cap on it, I think it's around $104,000. I'm sure you know the exact figure. Some people advocate, let's just lift the cap. So a person making $28 million a year, his cap ends at $104,000. You take off the cap, problem solved. Is it that simple?
It's not that simple, but that would go a long way towards correcting the problem. Just for context, back in 1983, the last time Social Security underwent some major revision, about 90% of people's income on average was taxed for Social Security. You don't pay 90% of your income, but 90% of your income was the basis on which the tax was applied. Now, that's gone down. That was not indexed for inflation or anything like that. So that figure has gone down to more like 82% of income. And so basically anyone making over $110,000 a year today, that's the figure, is $110,000.
Okay.
Anything over that is not taxed, is not subject to tax for Social Security.
The FICA tax, right.
Yeah. And so if you so there's an awful lot of income that more affluent people have above $110,000 that is not taxed for Social Security. If that figure was raised so that the percentage of income was brought back to that 90% that we had 30 years ago, most of that deficit would disappear. Not all of it, and those people would be getting higher benefits because they're putting more money in, but an awful lot of that deficit would disappear. It would be a very simple move and a very equitable one.
What about a means test as well? Somebody who's 65 and they're still working, they're making $75,000 a year, they're eligible for their Social Security. Does a means test make sense within this context?
I'm opposed to a means test, and I discuss this a lot in People's Pension. Because this is always the solution is proposed on the right. Why does Bill Gates, for example, get Social Security? Why does Warren Buffett get Social Security? But it's a misunderstanding of what Social Security is about. Social Security is not a poverty program. It does a lot to alleviate poverty, but it's really an income support program for everyone. Everybody contributes to it, and so everybody should get something. If you start to, and the great thing politically about Social Security over the years is that it has a lot of support from higher income and middle class people because they get something out of it. In fact, given the fact that private pensions and home equity and other means of supporting yourself in your old age are disappearing these days, this is particularly a problem in places like the Detroit area, Michigan, where older industries are collapsing or have been phased out, and the pensions that those jobs used to provide to people are being canceled out or frozen or turned into 401k plans. Social Security is more important for people than ever. And even for middle class people or people who consider themselves middle class. And so if you start to means test Social Security for those people, you begin to erode the support for the system. There'll be less support pretty soon. What you've done is you will have turned Social Security into a welfare program, which it is not. And once something turns into a welfare program, we know what happens to it in this country. It gets cut. It gets eliminated. And that's what we don't want to see.
Well, the idea that, that this helps people out of poverty, I mean, I know an elderly guy, he gets $700 a month, period. I mean, it seems to me that rather than cutting Social Security, that we ought to be raising it considerably, particularly for people like him. How can you live on $700 a month? I mean, he barely does.
That's an incredibly good point, and that's something I really, as I was writing The People's Pension, I began to concentrate on this more and more. I have a chapter at the end of the book called The Real Retirement Crisis that's about what's really going on. People in this country have less and less to support them outside of Social Security. In fact, with medical costs going up, more and more of the money people get from Social Security each month, they're having to pay in out-of-pocket medical expenses, which was never the idea. That was all supposed to be covered by Medicare. So people are more dependent on the program than ever. It is not an overly generous program. You know, you have this image of, greedy oldsters in gated communities getting money that should go to the young. This is not true. Over half the people on Social Security rely on it for more than half of their income. More than a third of people on Social Security have only Social Security. And it's the least generous anti-poverty or program for the aged in the industrialized world. There's the real tragedy of the debate and of the history that I tell in The People's Pension, to me, is that this constant discussion of is it solvent, is it going to be there, do we need to put more money into it, sort of ignores the fact that we need Social Security more than ever, and the tragedy is that it needs to be improved in a lot of ways and hasn't been. The minimum benefit needs to be raised for people who spend their whole lives working in low-income or minimum-wage jobs, and that's a growing portion of the people in this country. It needs to be improved for widows and for divorcees. It needs to be, how about same-sex couples or even non-same-sex couples who are not married, who get no benefits from social, get lower benefits from Social Security because they're not married. All of this, there's lots of ways in which it needs to be updated, and it's very important for a program like this to keep up with the times, to keep up with the needs of the people it serves. Otherwise, it tends to lose support and it tends to atrophy. So that's the real tragedy, is that this kind of circular discussion over solvency 30, 40, 50, 75 years from now has deflected attention from the fact that, A, we need Social Security more than ever, and, B, it needs to be improved and updated.
The book is The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. My guest is Eric Larson, the author. It's published by AK Press. You can go to akpress.org. I'll give all that information again when we're through. In The People's Pension, do you treat the sort of philosophical base of this? The Republicans, of course, back in the early 30s opposed, or was it the late 30s, I guess, opposed the establishment of Social Security at all. And as you say in your subtitle, there's been a struggle to defend Social Security since Reagan. So there's this philosophical gap. I mean, at the extreme right, that it said that, this is a country built on individuals. We should all pack our own parachute. And if people haven't made arrangements to take care of themselves and itself in their old age, or their families haven't, well, that's just kind of too bad. I mean, it's not real warm-hearted, but that's the way it shapes up.
Yeah, this is what you hear now, especially from the Tea Party, since the election a couple of years ago. And I would just say that it's very easy to say that, and it sounds very American to say everybody has to shift for themselves. But number one, remember a couple of things that the greatest generation, the 50s and 60s post-war generation that built this country, built this extraordinarily prosperous economy, was built on government programs like Social Security, the GI Bill, federal housing loans, Social Security, Medicare, one thing after another. It was actually a very subsidized generation, if you think about it.
Let me just interrupt. But I think the rebuttal to that would be, well, that's why we have this enormous debt and deficit, because of all those. And we're just, whatever, maybe in one regard, whatever our philosophy is, we just can't afford it.
Yeah, that would be the argument. First of all, I would say that again, it's very easy to say that, and it sounds very philosophically consistent and so forth. What happens though when elderly people their benefits are reduced, are cut back, and they're not able to support themselves? They're not able to live on their own. They're not able to cover their costs. Who do they fall back on? Well, number one is they fall back on their families, a lot of whom are hard-pressed working people. We're not making much money. Suddenly you have multi-generational households doubling up and are really pressed financially. And so the problem with a lot of this, otherwise you go on to relief. You go on to whatever programs local communities have, states, local governments. Those programs become overstrained. I guess my point is that if Social Security is reduced, canceled, privatized, the need for those benefits doesn't go away. It just devolves onto somebody else. It devolves onto other levels of government and onto families. And then we've got a situation where a lot of people are in trouble.
Eric, let me interrupt you because this is incredible. Eric is trying to make a summation of an 800-page book. It's absolutely incredible. Everything that is important to know, including the history of Social Security. It's called The People's Pension. But I wanted to get to one thing. Often people say, look, I'm winding up. I'm going to get $1,300 a month. From the time I started working when I was 18 or 19, if this would have all been in a Wall Street investment, I'd be a millionaire by now. One of the quote reforms is that people have the option to have private accounts where they think they could do much better, wind up with much more money at the retirement age. How do you answer that?
Well, there's a lot of problems with that. Number one is that if you have a private account, you pay fees for it to be managed, and those fees can be very, very high. That reduces your benefits. Secondly, an awful lot depends on your timing, which you don't have a whole lot of control over. What if you had retired just after the dot-com bust? What if you had retired just after the housing bust? There's a million factors that you have no control over that will dictate whether you will have the assets you have today or whether you'll have one-third less or half less. You just don't know. You can be the smartest investor in the world, and you can't time this sort of thing. Number two is that I think at the risk of sounding cynical, it's very important to take a look at what's actually being done here. If everybody had private accounts or had to have private accounts somehow, who's really benefiting? It's probably Wall Street. You can think of this in a way as welfare for Wall Street. Something $80 billion, I've heard, there's various estimates for how much money would pour into Wall Street in fees if everybody had a private account. This is something that I think that they are counting on to some extent to bail them out from their from the reckless trading.
Eric Larson, let me stop you there because we got 1 minute left, and I want to get this in. You mentioned that all the presidents have talked about limiting Social Security in one manner or another. So I don't know if you can do this in 60 seconds, but Barack Obama, is he going to try to cut Social Security? And whoever's trying to do it, what should we be doing to stop it?
Yeah, this was the surprising conclusion right at the end of my book is Barack Obama did it too. Last summer, he tried to make a deal with John Boehner, the House Speaker, which would have rejiggered the formula that's used for computing benefits for each new worker that enters Social Security when they retire, and it would have eroded that benefit. There would have been a significant erosion of benefits. Even over the first 10 years, it would have affected even people who are retired now. And more and more, the people who really would have been hit are people who are younger workers today. So Obama made a very significant proposal to cut Social Security last year.
Unfortunately, we don't have any more time with Eric Larson, because one way to deal with this, he says, is take this all out of the hands of Washington and allow workers and retirees who are in the Social Security system to directly elect the trustees who run the program. What a concept. Hey, there is so much in this incredible 800-page book from AK Press. You can go to akpress.org. It's The People's Pension, The Struggle to Defend Social Security Since Reagan. You can also just Google People's Pension, and you will also get Eric Larson's blog and how to order everything. There will also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Eric Larson, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thanks very much, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIN. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.